in partnership with Cambridge University.
Ooh la la.
This Monday to Friday afternoon at 3:30 on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
Okay, so I think now we are finished.
On FM, on digital and on BBC Sounds, this is BBC Radio 4.
Good morning, it's 6 o'clock on Monday the 16th of September. This is Today with Justin Webb in London and Nick Robinson in Ipswich.
The headlines this morning, the FBI is investigating what appears to be a second assassination attempt against Donald Trump. This time he was playing golf in Florida. The local sheriff described just how close the suspect was to the former president.
Probably between 300 and 500 yards, but with a rifle and a scope like that, that's not a long distance.
We'll be speaking to a former Secret Service agent at 10 past 8. We'll get the thoughts as well of a close friend of Donald Trump's. And one other headline, Sir Keir Starmer is holding talks in Rome where he'll discuss how the UK can follow Italy in dramatically reducing the number of migrant crossings. The Home Secretary, Yvette Cooper, will join us live.
Also in today's programme, the Japanese historical drama Shogun makes history.
And the Emmy goes to Shogun.
And that seals the record for the most single-season Emmy wins. We'll speak to its British director, Jonathan Van Tulleken. And all this week, we'll be covering stories suggested by listeners who applied to work with us earlier this year. Today, it is the turn of Vanessa and Toby, who asked us to look at why pupil numbers are falling so much in London.
We moved here when he was three. I remember touring around primary schools and, you know, the primary schools were so overcrowded, they were teaching kids in the corridor. And then 10 years later, four primary schools have closed in this area in the last 2 years.
That is all after the BBC News, read this morning by Charles Carroll.
The US Secret Service has thwarted a suspected assassination attempt on Donald Trump while he was playing golf at his resort in Florida. The former president was rushed to safety when agents spotted an assault rifle aimed towards the course. A suspect has been arrested. Our North America editor, Sarah Smith, is in West Palm Beach and sent this report.
Donald Trump was only about 300 to 500 yards away when Secret Service agents spotted the barrel of a rifle poking through some bushes on the perimeter of the golf course and opened fire. The suspect fled the scene in a car. A witness took pictures of the vehicle and the license plate, and a man was later arrested. He has been named in US media as 58-year-old Ryan Wesley Routh. An assault rifle and scope, along with two backpacks and a GoPro camera, were later found at the scene. BBC Verify has seen social media posts, apparently from the suspect, which suggest he was involved in efforts to get foreign fighters into Ukraine. In an email to supporters, Mr. Trump said his resolve was only stronger after another attempt on his life. Nothing will slow me down, he added. I will never surrender.
Sir Keir Starmer is expected to discuss how the UK could follow Italy in dramatically reducing the number of migrant crossings when he holds talks with the country's Prime Minister, Giorgia Meloni, later today. The two will meet in Rome as part of Sir Keir's wider bid to reset Britain's relationship with Europe. But immigration is likely to be high on the agenda, a day after eight migrants died when their boat capsized while trying to cross the Channel. Our political correspondent, Alex Forsyth, is travelling with the Prime Minister.
Sir Keir Starmer hopes to learn from Italy, which has seen the number of migrants crossing from North Africa fall by more than 60% in the past year. Financial deals with Tunisia and Libya to strengthen border security are seen to be key. And Italy has also agreed a plan with Albania to process asylum claims, something that Prime Minister's confirmed he's interested in. But the Italian approach hasn't been without controversy, with human rights groups among those expressing concern. After scrapping the Rwanda scheme, the government's focus has been on disrupting people smuggling gangs. The Conservatives claim Labour is posturing with no real plan.
New border controls are coming into force in Germany on the country's north and western boundaries. Spot checks will take place on vehicles crossing from countries such as Denmark, the Netherlands and France. The coalition government in Berlin announced the measures in response to recent political gains by the far right and a heightened debate about immigration after three people were allegedly stabbed to death by a failed asylum seeker in the city of Solingen. Magistrates in England and Wales could be given powers to hand down longer custodial sentences under proposals to help reduce the backlog in Crown Courts and cut the number of prisoners on remand. Ministers are considering a change in the law to double from 6 to 12 months the maximum punishment that can be handed out for a single offence. More details from our political correspondent, Joe Pike.
Magistrates can currently jail criminals for up to 6 months for a single offence. By increasing that to a year, they will be able to try more serious crimes. In turn, that could reduce the backlog of cases in Crown Courts and also reduce the number of prisoners on remand, those waiting for trial who have not been convicted or sentenced. In response to the proposals first reported by the Daily Telegraph, a Ministry of Justice spokesperson said the new government inherited prisons on the point of collapse and long-term options are being considered.
An independent commission is to begin its hearing into alleged breaches of the Premier League's financial rules by Manchester City. The football club is facing more than 100 charges. Man City denies any wrongdoing but could be fined, deducted points or even relegated if found guilty by the panel. The Polish Prime Minister, Donald Tusk, says that his government will declare a state of natural disaster because of severe flooding caused by Storm Boris. At least 8 people have been killed in Central and Eastern Europe, including 4 on the Polish-Czech border, from where our Eastern Europe correspondent Sarah Rainsford reports.
The torrential rain has eased now, but there is a high risk of further flooding still as swollen rivers pour down the mountains. In Nysa, in southwestern Poland, the town centre is completely swamped, and we saw a main road transformed into a fast-flowing river, trapping a fire engine and a military truck in the middle. Patients at the emergency department of the local hospital had to be evacuated by boat as the building flooded. People living near the river and the reservoir here have been ordered to leave and move to higher ground.
The historical epic Shogun has won the prestigious Best Drama Award at the Emmys in Los Angeles, becoming the first foreign language TV show to take the top prize. The series, which tells the story of warring dynasties in feudal Japan, won a total of 18 prizes. There were also wins for the Netflix series Baby Reindeer and the American comedy Hacks.
Thank you, Giles. 6 minutes past 6. What's the weather got in store for us? A bit warmer, Helen, is it, today and the rest of the week?
Yeah, it is looking warmer, actually, Nick. Certainly by day, by night, really quite chilly. We've got high pressure moving in for the week, but those September nights are long enough that the mist and the fog that forms will last now through the first hour or two of the morning rush. So that's a clear concern, and there's actually a Met Office yellow warning out for that. So just the first of the season and widespread issues expected across parts of northwest England, North Wales and down into the northwest Midlands. And as we start with England and Wales, even further south, we've got what's left over of yesterday's weather front in the far south. It's a bit misty down here and it's a bit drizzly as well. There's some fog around the coast and over the hills, but that's clearing. And the fog further north will clear as well. And plenty of sunshine will be enjoyed by all if that's what you like. And after the chilly start away from that rather drizzly weather in the south, temperatures will recover to more widely 18 to 20 compared with yesterday, locally 21, 22. So warm and sunny for the majority and still fairly strong sunshine. And that's what's lifting the temperatures across Northern Ireland, or will do so. Any early bits of mist and fog here to clear and then plenty of sunshine. And if you're going out in your jacket, which you'll need this morning, that can be shed this afternoon as we get to 18 or 20 degrees Celsius. Very similar story as we head into Scotland as well. A little bit of mist and fog first thing. We've got a weather front close to the far north of Scotland, which will keep things a little cloudier at times here through the day. But actually, for the majority, after the mist and fog clears, there'll be plenty of sunshine around. That will allow those temperatures starting at 2 or 3 in some areas to get to between 15 and 18 degrees Celsius.
Helen, thank you. 6:08 is the time. Let's have our first look at the papers. And targeted again is how the Times sums up what the FBI have called an apparent assassination attempt on Donald Trump. Agents swoop on would-be Trump assassin, the headline in the Express. Some of the papers, including the Mirror, the Daily Mail, picking up on comments from the Fox News presenter, Sean Hannity, who said he'd spoken to the former president shortly after the event. He said Mr. Trump had heard a pop, pop while playing the fifth hole in his golf club in Florida before being rushed to safety.
The Telegraph says Mr. Trump's security had been ramped up after his ear was grazed in a previous assassination attempt at a rally in Pennsylvania in July. The New York Times says that whilst this latest incident was only stopped by what the paper calls the swift, keen-eyed response of Secret Service agents. It has intensified questions about the agency's broader protective capabilities.
Many of the papers look ahead to Sir Keir Starmer's meeting with the Italian Prime Minister, Giorgia Meloni, for talks today. The Times says he'll be trying to learn lessons from Italy's crackdown on illegal migration. The Guardian reports there's concern among Labour backbenchers who are critical of Ms. Meloni's approach. The paper also quotes the Refugee Council, Amnesty International as well, calling on Sir Keir to avoid what they're calling gimmicks. The I says the deaths of eight people trying to cross the channel yesterday morning adds poignancy to the leaders' meeting.
The Guardian says the government is planning to appoint a special envoy for nature for the first time as part of efforts to put Britain at the centre of global efforts to tackle the ecological crisis, or indeed crises. The paper says there'll also be a climate envoy, a post abolished by the previous government more than a year ago. It's understood several prominent figures are being considered for the role, but neither of the appointments has yet been decided.
It's noted in many of the papers that for the first time in 3 years, the royal family publicly wished the Duke of Sussex a happy birthday on social media as he celebrated turning 40. Peace, spelled P-E-A-C-E, of cake is the Sun's headline. The Daily Mirror describes it as an olive branch. The Times, though, isn't so sure, but does say the messages hint at the possibility of a return to civil relations. The Metro says the gesture was a sign their royal rift could be healing.
The Telegraph reports that people are increasingly turning to Botox jabs to cure so-called tech neck, which is described as the pain and inflammation caused from time hunching over smartphones and laptops. The paper says doctors have reported a rise in people coming forward for the treatment, with one private medic saying he treats up to 100 patients a year with Botox for that condition.
And the Times shares the news that a cat believed to be the world's oldest has died at her home in Norwich at the age of 33. Her owner, Lily Brissett, who's had Rosie since she was a kitten, said there were a lot of good memories. She was glad they'd had their time together.
It is now 11 minutes past six.
New border controls come into operation in Germany today. Let's talk to Jess Parker, our Berlin correspondent. What's happening, Jess? Because there are already some controls that have already started.
Yeah, good morning. So these are spot checks. As you say, they're already in place on Germany's southern and eastern borders. And I've seen those, actually. And it's pretty mixed how impactful they are or how much you notice them. The new ones are coming into force on the sort of north and western borders of Germany. But when I saw them in operation towards the end of last year, I mean, there was like a quiet country road on the Czech border and there was absolutely nobody there, no police presence, nothing. But they do sometimes have these sort of mobile forces going around. But then on the Polish border, it was much more noticeable, a highway coming from Poland into Germany. There was quite a big traffic queue, at least in part caused, it seemed, from these controls, where vans, lorries, vehicles that effectively might be able to conceal people within them were being routinely pulled over and inspected. And I imagine that is the sort of thing you're going to see on the north and western borders where these new controls are coming in. But I think the efficacy of these spot checks will be questioned. As I say, already in place in the south and eastern borders where there are known migrant routes. The northern border with Denmark, which is one of the areas where there'll be new controls, less so. But the checks now will cover basically all of Germany's borders, coming into force, though, today, France, Luxembourg, Belgium, the Netherlands, etc.
And is it fair to say it's the result of public opinion broadly? It's not just the far right. There is a kind of sense that, well, there have been some really high-profile crimes, haven't there, committed by people who've come from outside Germany, but a kind of broader public sense that something needs to be done.
Yeah, but something I think you're seeing reflected in elections at the moment in the east of Germany. So we've had very recently, of course, the elections in Saxony and Thuringia, where the far right Alternative for Deutschland did do very well. And then you've got Brandenburg, another regional election coming this Sunday. And guess who's polling top? Yes, it's Alternative for Deutschland. So I think that is the political context, but also a pressure, a wider pressure, as you say, to respond to this issue, particularly in the wake of the knife attack in Solingen, the city of Solingen. The man accused there is a Syrian asylum seeker. And I think that really fired up the immigration debate even more. And also, I think since then, you've seen, for example, the CDU, conservative opposition, they've been coming out being very vocal. It looked at times like the government was struggling for a voice or for relevance, but they've come up with this measure. They also plan to tighten asylum laws. I think ministers are trying to get some control of the narrative, and I think immigration certainly looks to be a, if not possibly the key issue as we head towards those federal elections next year.
Jess Parker in Berlin. Thank you.
14 minutes past six. Stand by for endless references to Succession, Logan Roy and the battle between the children, because the real-life battle for control of Rupert Murdoch's media empire arrives at a pivotal moment today as a court case in the United States looks set to decide who will control the family trust. Sean Farrington is the man with the enviable job of following that and bringing us the rest of the business news. Morning, Sean.
Thanks, Nick. I'm glad you got all those out of the way. That means we can just get straight into the nub of what is going on business-wise. Media baron Rupert Murdoch and one son, Lachlan, set to face off in a legal battle against three of his other kids, Prudence, Elizabeth and James. These proceedings start today, taking place behind closed doors in a Nevada courthouse, where Rupert Murdoch will reportedly be trying to defend changes to a trust that currently grants his four eldest children equal voting rights over his businesses when he dies. But he wants some changes to that. Brian Weezer is the chief executive and principal at Madsen & Wall, longtime media analyst, joins us from Portland in Oregon over in the US. Morning, Brian.
Morning. Thanks for having me.
What exactly is at stake with this particular hearing, Brian?
Well, to the extent that this determines one way or the other who really controls all of the assets of both News Corp and Fox when Rupert Murdoch eventually passes on, it does have implications for the direction of those businesses. Do they stay together as a single or two different businesses? Do they get broken up? Is there a change of editorial control, which matters mostly for Fox News, the New York Post, perhaps, and maybe more than any other assets? What does it do for, do they sell some pieces? There's a lot of questions that will be answered by the direction that comes out of this course case.
Is it all about trying to have influence on those various bits of media that they control at the moment? You know, having the likes of the Sun and the Times here in the UK, as well as Fox in the US, or is there money top of the tree?
Well, this is the thing we don't really know. I mean, how much it is about money is hard, if not possible, to really know. We know there's reporting out there, and certainly anyone who's known, even just generally the individuals involved, we know that James Murdoch has different views than Lachlan and Rupert do. Sounds like the other siblings are closer to James than they are to Lachlan. But not necessarily entirely. So we don't really know. We do know that there are legitimate reasons for concern about the editorial or
Brian's line
concern that. Yeah, I don't think there's any widespread concern about assets in Australia or the Times necessarily, but Fox News in particular does seem to be a place where obviously there's a lot of concern.
And meanwhile, Brian, alongside this, just at the beginning of last week, we had a major shareholder in News Corp, Starboard, calling for the removal of this current share structure that is in place at the moment, all to do with voting rights. They've almost want the Murdochs to have less power, it seems. Investors right to be worried about the direction of the business?
Well, I don't know that this says investors should be worried about the direction of the business because of what Starboard's doing. Personally, I think there's always an issue when you have dual class or multi-class structures to companies. But with that said,
just explain what that is briefly, what that means.
So you have some shareholders who have more of a vote than others, essentially. This is how the Murdochs can control News Corp, by having less of an equity ownership of the company, but more voting control of the company. You see this in a lot of media companies in the United States or that are based in the U.S. And if Snap, for example, Evan Spiegel and Bobby Murphy control 100% of the company, nobody else has a vote. Doesn't matter how much shares you have no vote. And so these kinds of companies are very common. Shareholders typically know what they're buying into. It's hard to see how you change that structure once the companies have been created. Not impossible, I guess. Otherwise, Starboard would be trying it. It could also be a negotiating ploy to try to pursue other changes that Starboard would like to see.
Brian, in almost a word, will Rupert Murdoch get his way?
Hard to say. How's that for three words?
That will do, Brian. We'll come back to you when we know more. Brian Weezer, Chief Executive and Principal at Madison & Wall over in the United States. Lindsay James, Investment Strategist at Quilter Investors. Morning, Lindsay. You'll have more than three words. Hope you are well. Interest rates this week here in the UK, over in the United States. Which one are you watching more closely?
Well, to be honest, it's the US. They're leading the charge with this on Wednesday, and they are expected to make a cut. The question is whether it's going to be a quarter point cut or a half a point cut. And then we've got the UK the next day on Thursday, where no cut is actually expected in September. It's given just a 25% chance from markets at the moment. But two more are priced in by the end of the year, and significant cuts, around five, are actually expected by next summer. So we'll be looking for more guidance from the Bank of England on their thoughts around that.
Talking house prices after 7 o'clock this morning, are you starting to see the interest rate environment have an impact on whether it's confidence in the housing market, confidence generally amongst shoppers, spenders?
Well, yes, we are a little bit. Now, we've seen very strong data out this morning showing that house sales and listings are picking up in September. Now, I think it's early days. We've still got high mortgage rates, but with rates expected to come down so significantly over the next 12 months, I think perhaps that is a sign that buyers are starting to warm up a little bit, having, you know, had really a buyer's strike now for a couple of years as a result of those very high mortgage rates.
Changing topic, Lindsay, to Shein, the fast fashion retailer, Chinese fast fashion retailer. In comments to the Financial Times that have just been published in the last hour or so, it seems, the chair of the Business Select Committee here in the UK, the Labour MP, Liam Byrne, has called on his own government to ban imported products made by forced labour in the Chinese region of Xinjiang, saying there should be more scrutiny of Shein's potential listing on the London stock markets. Do you expect this kind of political sound to increase now, a Labour government, and you have the chair of the Business Select Committee saying these kinds of things?
There was already an enormous amount of scrutiny, to be honest, on Shein, and that's because it is it's a major supplier of fashion. It's bigger than Zara and H&M put together. It's looking to potentially list in London, but of course it manufactures in China, and there are continuing rumours about their exposure to that Xinjiang region where Uyghur forced labour is widely recognised as being used. So investors are keen for that due diligence to be done. They want it to be scrutinised carefully, but it's just this balance between making sure that the London Stock Exchange has a fair chance to secure this listing, because listings have been in short supply, and also making sure that that due diligence, those standards stay very, very high.
Shein saying that it has a zero tolerance policy regarding forced labour. And the car market, Lindsay, new hybrid cars to be allowed to stay on the market until 2035 now, it seems. So maybe not 2030 as Labour had in its manifesto. We'll get more details in the coming days and weeks, no doubt. Traditional car manufacturers be pretty happy with that, will they?
Well, I think they'll be relieved to hear it. But I mean, not a week goes by, it feels like, when we don't hear a different standard or a different date about changes to this policy. Now, we had several under the Conservative government. The Labour government had promised stability. Now, in their manifesto, they did commit to removing cars with pure internal combustion engines by 2030, but they were quite ambiguous about hybrids. But they are retaining the rules that are going to force auto manufacturers to ramp up the sale of EVs. But I think we just had that weak demand coming through, and they're really probably just trying to help out auto manufacturers here to give them a chance of profitability in what's quite a difficult market for them.
Lindsay, good to talk to you this morning. Lindsay James from Quilter Investors. Now, charitable giving by Britain's largest listed companies has failed to keep pace with profits over the past 10 years, according to new research by the Charities Aid Foundation. Its latest report suggests the FTSE 100's combined profits were up almost 50% since 2014, but total donations down by just over 10% in the same period, or by more than a third if how prices have gone up are taken into account in that time. Neil Heslop is the chief executive of the Charities Aid Foundation, works with businesses and individuals to improve the impact of their donations to charities around the world. Neil, morning.
Good morning, Sean.
So when you speak to businesses, what do they tell you the reasons are behind this?
I think there's a whole variety of reasons. Obviously, the economic environment, business performance, everyone knows how challenging it's been for everyone over the last year. And I think there has been a case where there's been some fantastic case studies and lots of companies do amazing things across the piece. As you say, you know, profits over the last 10 years have increased by 49%. But the deployment of those profits into community investment through charitable corporate giving is down by 34%.
Is there?
We think it's really important that, given the Prime Minister's talked about a decade of national renewal, One aspect of that is a renewal in the British culture of giving, and businesses have a huge part to play in that. And especially the largest companies can be really effective in leading the way right across the business community.
But I mean, still, even if we just look last year, the UK's 100 biggest listed companies on the stock markets in that FTSE 100 gave a total of £1.82 billion to charity last year. So the clearly that the will is still there.
I think the picture's a bit mixed, Sean. In some cases, as I say, some companies are doing a tremendous amount. Others are doing somewhat less.
Do you see different sectors? Sorry to interrupt you, Neil.
0.9% of profit is going, and that's what equates to that 1.8 billion. If you look across the 870,000 businesses that are a quarter of £1 million or more, some 75% are not giving anything at all. And were it the case that best practice was being adopted by all businesses, that would represent an additional £5 billion to that 1.8 that you're talking about.
Are there certain sectors you think should be stepping up?
Yeah, very much so. I mean, I think it's important to celebrate those sectors that are doing a tremendous job. Healthcare, certain retailers are really pulling their weight. But for example, the telecom sector is somewhat surprisingly is at the bottom, and we'd like to see a more uniform approach across all sectors.
And Neil, we've got a budget coming up. Do you expect there to be announcements from the government that restrict this even more or encourage it further?
Well, we're certainly calling on to the new government that what they need to do is to arrest the decline that we've seen both in business and more broadly in society. And actually, there's an opportunity for a national strategy on philanthropy and charitable giving.
Right.
And organisations such as ours are putting forward a lot of proposals about how the government can use its considerable power to nudge the right kind of behaviour that reverses some of these long-term trends.
Neil, thank you. Neil Heslop there, Chief Executive of the Charities Aid Foundation.
Sean, thank you. 26 minutes past six. Carthy is here with the sport.
Morning, thank you very much. The Arsenal manager Mikel Arteta described their 1-0 victory over Tottenham yesterday as one of his most important wins, with key players being missing. Arsenal have now defeated Tottenham away for three seasons in a row and are just 2 points off Premier League leaders Manchester City.
We were missing certain players that I didn't want to expose the game into their biggest strength, and we have to adapt to that, and we were so disciplined and eager to achieve that, so I'm very pleased with that as well.
Newcastle United are in third place after they came from behind to beat Wolves 2-1, and Manchester City's independent hearing where they face 115 charges for allegedly breaking the Premier League's financial rules starts today. We will discuss that later in the programme. Rangers beat Dundee United 1-0 to move back to within 5 points of Celtic and Aberdeen, who are leading the Scottish Premiership. Golf, and there was a great effort from Team Europe to pull themselves back from 10-6 down against America to make it a thrilling finish in the Solheim Cup. The USA, though, won by 15.5 points to 12.5 points, ending their seven-year Solheim Cup drought. The BBC's golf correspondent Ian Carter reports from Virginia.
It was closer than expected, much closer, as a spirited European fight back took the match to the wire. In the end, America's 4-point lead built up over the first 2 days proved decisive. It didn't matter that Charlie Hull posted a big win over Nelly Korda and Georgia Hall eased past Alison Lee, because as determined as Europe were, the Americans could do it with halved matches, decisively so when Lilia Vu birdied the last two holes to tie Alban Valenzuela and edge the US home in what had become a nerve-jangling contest.
Rory McIlroy admitted he's getting used to near misses after he led by four strokes yesterday at the Irish Open but finished in second place to Rasmus Højgaard, who won by just one shot at Royal County Down. Tennis, and British number four Sonia Cartel won her maiden WTA Tour title in Tunisia, and she moves into the world's top 100 for the first time, while Great Britain will not progress to the Davis Cup finals in November after they were defeated by Canada in Manchester. Cricket, and Ireland women beat England by 5 wickets to draw the two-match series. England and Australia's T20 men's series also ended in a draw after the third match was washed out by rain. And Oscar Piastri won Formula One's Azerbaijan Grand Prix. McLaren teammate Lando Norris finished in fourth place to move to 59 points behind championship leader Max Verstappen. There are just 7 races left this season.
Carthy, thank you very much indeed. Later this morning, Radio 4 tells the gripping story of a dramatic event.
On Wednesday, the 30th of April 1980, 6 gunmen have stormed the Iranian embassy in London, taking 26 hostages.
The new book from the best-selling author Ben McIntyre.
Sound stethoscopes could be inserted into the party walls to eavesdrop on the gunmen.
Drawing on unpublished source material and exclusive interviews.
Despite the Prime Minister's stated desire for a bloodless conclusion, that prospect was already remote.
The Siege by Ben McIntyre.
The SAS are coiled, ready to strike.
On Radio 4 and BBC Sounds. Starts this morning at 11:45.
Time now is just a tad before 6:30. You're listening to Today on Radio 4. Nick Robinson in Ipswich, Justin Webb in London and Charles Carroll with the news.
The FBI says it's investigating what appears to be a second assassination attempt on Donald Trump as he was playing golf in Florida. An assault rifle was spotted poking out of some bushes by a Secret Service agent. A suspected gunman has been detained. US media have named him as Ryan Ralph, a 58-year-old from Hawaii. The White House said President Biden was relieved to hear the former president was safe, while Mr. Trump's Democratic rival in November's election, Kamala Harris, said there was no room for violence in US politics. The Prime Minister is facing renewed pressure to rethink the UK's immigration policies after 8 migrants died while trying to cross the Channel yesterday. Migration will be high on the agenda when Sir Keir Starmer holds talks with the Italian Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni in Rome later on today. Magistrates in England and Wales could be given power to jail criminals for longer under government plans. By trying more serious offences and handing down longer sentences, ministers hope magistrates' courts could help to bring down the backlog at Crown Courts and ease prison overcrowding. A hearing will begin today into allegations that Manchester City breached the Premier League's financial rules 115 times between 2009 and 2018. The club denies any wrongdoing but could be fined, deducted points or even relegated if found guilty. The Scottish Government is said to be close to agreeing a deal for Glasgow to host the 2026 Commonwealth Games. Australia, which pulled out of holding the event, has promised a multi-million pound investment to support Glasgow's bid. And Baby Reindeer, the chilling British TV hit about a bartender stalked by a customer, has taken the Emmy Awards by storm, winning 3 trophies for its creator, Richard Gadd, and 1 for its co-star, Jessica Gunning. The Japanese historical drama Shogun made history, winning 18 gongs, including in the Best Drama category, while Hacks won Best Comedy Series. Its main rival, The Bear, won 3 of the 4 awards for comedy acting.
Thank you. 28 minutes to 7 is the time. Donald Trump is safe and a man is in custody, but once again America is facing what appears to have been an attempt at assassination. It happened at Donald Trump's golf course in Florida. Tom Bateman is there. And Tom, there were shots fired, but do we know yet by whom?
Well, we know that shots were fired by the Secret Service at the assailant. So that was confirmed in this joint news conference a few hours ago by the FBI and the local sheriff's office. The key question is whether or not the gunman fired towards either the Secret Service agents or Donald Trump. Now, that question was asked directly to the FBI and to the local police during this news conference, and they've simply said that is something they are investigating. So we don't know the answer to that pretty crucial question, because remember what they have said happened here. It was as Donald Trump was heading towards the 6th hole of his golf course, and that's just behind some bushes I'm at now, at the very corner of his golf club. And it was this advanced security sweep by the Secret Service that spotted the barrel of this assault rifle pointing through a chain link fence in the shrubs. And that's when they say they engaged, they opened fire on this suspect. They haven't said whether or not he was hit. They didn't seem to know the answer to that, although, of course, they've apprehended somebody 40 miles north of here in his car. And then, crucially, whether or not he opened fire at them, they said they are still investigating that.
Yeah, and the man they've apprehended, they've named or has been named anonymously as Ryan Wesley Ralph, hasn't he? Do we know anything more about him?
Yeah, we know he's a 58-year-old former construction worker, originally from North Carolina, but had been living more recently in Hawaii. some details emerging from his various social media profiles, but also quite well documented in the US media that he was a very strong supporter of Ukraine in its war against Russia and had travelled there in the last couple of years at least once. He'd been interviewed by the New York Times and some other media while he was there and appeared to be, or at least he claimed that he had acted as a volunteer to try to recruit fighters for what Ukraine calls its international legion. So that's, you know, volunteer fighters, many thousands of whom have travelled to Ukraine and were doing so in very large numbers at the outset of the war. You know, quite a few different interviews he talked about his work doing that and his very, what appeared to be this very passionate belief in the cause of Ukraine. So that clearly at the moment, I think, will be one of the strands that investigators will be looking at here.
Tom Bateman, thank you.
It is now 26 minutes to seven. What can Britain learn from Italy's success in stopping the boats crossing the Mediterranean? That is one question on the agenda for Sir Keir Starmer in Rome today with his Italian counterpart, Giorgia Meloni. Watching carefully, our chief political correspondent, Henry Zeffman. Henry, intriguing this meeting. Meloni was liked by Rishi Sunak. Her politics is loathed by plenty of people on the left of politics in Italy and indeed in Britain. What does Keir Starmer think he might get from that meeting?
Inspiration for cutting small boat crossings. That's the reason that Keir Starmer is there with Giorgia Meloni today. And it's an issue that's been magnified this weekend, hasn't it? Yesterday, eight people died as they attempted to cross the channel. And Italy has seen the number of migrants crossing from North Africa fall by more than 60% in the past year. Now, how did Italy do that? Well, partly it's financial deals with Tunisia and Libya to strengthen border security there. There's also an asylum processing deal with Albania. Now, the difference between the Italian-Albanian deal and the UK-Rwanda deal, which Keir Starmer scrapped as practically his first act as Prime Minister, is that it's Italian officials doing the processing in Albania rather than Albanian officials, and also that if asylum seekers are found to have a valid asylum claim, then they can make their life in Italy rather than Albania. So it's very interesting to see what Keir Starmer can take from Giorgia Meloni there. But as you say, while he seeks inspiration on this specific policy area, there are some Labour MPs privately anxious about this, and one publicly so. Kim Johnson, who's on the left of the party, the Labour MP for Liverpool Riverside, told The Guardian it is disturbing that Keir Starmer is seeking to learn lessons from a neo-fascist government.
He says he's not interested in gimmicks, the Prime Minister, and has appointed a new head of border security. The Tories say that is a gimmick, it's just the rebadging of an old job.
That man is Martin Hewitt, and he's accompanying Keir Starmer in Italy today. He's a former chairman of the National Police Chiefs Council. Now, the government says the Border Security Command, which Martin Hewitt will lead, is a new entity. It will operate within the Home Office, but will be tasked with bringing together agencies like MI5, MI6, Border Force, the Crown Prosecution Service, to ensure that intelligence and investigations are better coordinated. And they point to new powers it will have to seize phones, financial records of suspected people smugglers, sort of counter-terrorism-like powers. But as you say, the previous government, previous Home Secretary James Cleverly, now running for Conservative leader, adamant that these are things that were already going on within the Home Office.
Henry Zeffman, thank you.
The time, 23 minutes to seven.
Well, more now in that tragedy in the Channel yesterday. Eight migrants dying when their boat capsized. And French police say they're facing sustained violence when they do try to stop the boats setting off across the Channel. Let's turn to our correspondent Simon Jones in Ambleteurs near Boulogne. Another tragedy. And the numbers do seem to be going up at the moment, Simon.
Well, I think that's a worrying thing, this idea that the people smugglers organising the crossings are packing more and more people onto these flimsy boats. Yesterday, around 60 people were on that boat that got into difficulty where I am at the moment. The boat got caught on rocks and simply deflated. It was brought back to shore, and you really couldn't believe that so many people tried to get on board that boat. And I think one telling thing was there was a rubber ring, the type of thing a child would use in a swimming pool, that was being used as a life jacket. And in fact, of the 60 or so people on board that boat, only around 10 of them actually had life jackets. Now, I think what's interesting is in the past, when we've had incidents of loss of life in the Channel, the French authorities have quickly pointed the finger at the UK, saying it's the pull factor of the UK. This is a British problem because the migrants want to get over to the UK. I noticed yesterday a bit more of a conciliatory tone. We had the chief official for this area come, Jacques Billon, and he was saying, actually, it's the people smugglers we need to focus on, which is going to very much chime with the view of the British authorities. But the French are saying it is really difficult to police this. They've got 1,700 officers working, trying to stop the boats from launching, but they're facing violence when they try to intervene. Some of that is from the migrants themselves. Some of that is from the people smugglers. Looking out to the Channel today, it's a bleak morning. It's raining. The waves are quite tall. I don't think we'll see any crossings this morning. But yesterday, even after the 8 deaths, there were more crossings, several boats making it halfway across the Channel and being escorted to Dover.
Simon Jones, thank you. We'll be hearing from the Home Secretary shortly after 10 past 8.
Time now is 21 minutes to 7. The hearing into Manchester City's 115 charges for alleged breaches of the Premier League's financial rules begins today. Dan Rowan's our sports editor. What exactly are they accused of doing, Dan?
Morning, Justin. Well, these 115 charges relate to the 14 seasons after City's Abu Dhabi takeover back in 2008, which, of course, transformed it into one of the richest clubs in the world. This was a period, these 14 seasons, in which they achieved unprecedented domination of the English game, winning several titles. And in effect, they are accused of subverting financial rules that limit club spending on players, in effect, cheating the regulations that the Premier League has. They include 54 counts of failing to provide accurate financial information over 9 seasons, 14 of not providing full details for manager and player payments, several counts of failing to comply with both UEFA and Premier League rules, and then also 35 counts of failure to cooperate with an investigation that was conducted over 4 years. In effect, the most serious charges relate to an allegation that City effectively inflated commercial revenue, Justin, by disguising direct investment from the club's Abu Dhabi owners as sponsorship income. Right. But it's important to stress the club denies all charges and say they have a body of irrefutable evidence that will, they say, clear them.
Well, indeed, and they'll put that forward. But to whom? I mean, who actually makes the decision?
Well, this is a Premier League arbitration disciplinary process. So it's a 3-person panel, an independent commission that's been set up to hear this specific case. It's expected to last around 10 weeks. It starts today at a location that hasn't been disclosed in central London.
Really? What is it? It's at a secret location. How bizarre.
Indeed. This is not held in public. This is an internal disciplinary process. Expected to last more than 2 months, and then there'll be a considerable amount of time potentially of deliberation. So it may not be until next year, but at least we expect by the end of the season that City do hear their fate. But this has been rumbling on now since 2018, would you believe, when allegations first came to light. The Premier League set up an investigation around that time, and they were charged, in fact, City back in February of 2023. So this has been rumbling on. This has become a huge saga for the league.
And is it right that ultimately it could require them to be relegated, which would be an extraordinary kind of world story, wouldn't it?
Unprecedented and seismic for a club that enjoys such domination. Yes, any punishment, any sanction is available to this commission. If they were found guilty of the most serious charges, I think, you know, City would risk being forever associated with one of the biggest financial scandals that sport's seen. And they could, yes, in theory, face a points deduction serious enough to condemn them to relegation or even expulsion from the Premier League. Now, such a fate would cast a long shadow, wouldn't it, over City's achievements. It would plunge the future of the manager, Pep Guardiola, and his squad into uncertainty. It could even spark claims for compensation. But again, City deny any wrongdoing. They're contesting all these charges. But there's no doubt, Justin, you know, this, for a case that's been billed as sport's trial of the century, today certainly marks a defining stage in a legal dispute the like of which English football has never seen. And as well as the club, there's a huge amount at stake for the Premier League as well at a time of various regulatory challenges.
Dan Rowan, thank you.
Time now to look at the papers at 17 minutes to 7. The news of the Prime Minister's visit to Rome, we were just discussing, makes it onto a number of the front pages. The I headline, PM sets sight on Italy-style migration deal to tackle small boats crisis. The way the Telegraph puts it on its front cover is undercover tactics deployed to smash Channel boats gangs. That's what they've been briefed. The new border security commander, Martin Hewitt, former Scotland Yard chief, will be deploying when he starts his new job. The Guardian, as we're hearing from Henry Zeffman, reporting unhappiness from refugee charities and some Labour MPs. Their headline, PM accused of seeking to copy far right on Migration Council. They don't like Giorgia Meloni, they don't like her government, they don't like the tactics. So Steve Valdez-Simmons, who's Amnesty International's UK Refugee and Migrant Rights Director, says to the paper, there should be no question of the UK doing deals to offload its responsibilities onto other countries, not Albania, Rwanda or anywhere else.
And two attacks on the government from rather different perspectives. The Daily Mail's front page, why can't millionaire Starmers buy their own clothes? This is about what the Mail calls the scandal of the PM's free suits and spectacles. His wife also dragged into Wardrobe Gate, as they rather predictably call it. But also an attack on the front page of the Financial Times from a very different perspective. And this is about cutting public investment in the UK, which would, according to a group of economists who've written to the FT, this is one of the first of these groups of economists' letter, at least that the new government has had to suffer. They say the foundations of the economy would be damaged by a lack of public investment. They warn the Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, that the fiscal rules that would lead to that lack of investment should themselves be changed. And it is a group of luminaries, including Jim O'Neill, former Treasury Minister under David Cameron, but also Mariana Mazzucato from University College London and others.
Quick look at the papers here in Suffolk. I'm broadcasting from Ipswich this morning. What is known here as the Anglian, East Anglian Daily Times, national paper of East Anglia, has the very exciting headline, Dad Slams Unreliable College Bus. We will turn past that story, which may be interesting here, but not, I suspect, for many of the rest of you, to a much more interesting and important story, actually, on its front page. Shock at level of child arrests. This is Suffolk's Police and Crime Commissioner expressing shock that 731 children were arrested in the county in 1 year alone. This was a Freedom of Information request showing that young people had been found guilty of, been arrested on suspicion of offences such as rape, murder, drug possession and robbery. And Tim Passmore, the county's police and crime commissioner, describes that as disturbing.
Right, more college bus news as we get it. The time now 14 minutes to 7. And the main headline this morning, US Secret Service agents have been praised for stopping an apparent assassination attempt on Donald Trump as he was playing golf in Florida.
There is, as we've often heard, a great backlog in the courts. One way of reducing that backlog may be giving the magistrates the power, the volunteers who run so many of our courts or the sentencing in many courts in England and Wales, giving them more powers to hand down longer custodial sentences, meaning that fewer cases have to go into the Crown Courts. Let's talk about that now with Tom Franklin, Chief Executive of the Magistrates Association. Morning to you.
Good morning.
Have you been told what the final arrangements are likely to be as to what you can and can't do in a magistrate court in future?
No. I have to say every time that we speak to officials and ministers with the Ministry of Justice, we do talk about this and we think it would be a good idea. But we don't know yet. We understand that they're obviously considering all sorts of things and we'll await to hear at some point in the future what they're going to do.
So just explain to people, what is the limit at the moment as to what magistrates can do, and what do you think the limit could usefully be increased to?
Well, at the moment, the limit for a single offence is for offences that could attract a maximum of a 6 months custodial sentence. What magistrates have already been trained on is to deal with slightly more serious cases. So if something like this happened, it would mean that the least serious cases currently being dealt with by Crown Courts could be dealt with as the most serious cases that magistrates' courts could deal with. And that could be for a maximum sentence of a year's imprisonment. It doesn't mean that would always be the sentence, because it depends on the particular circumstances for the case.
Just a brief last one, if I would. The good news is magistrate get through cases quicker
The bad news, if you're in government, could mean that there would be more people being sent to prison quicker, which at the moment is something they wouldn't welcome at all, would they?
Well, it does mean that justice is speeded up, and that's good for victims, witnesses and defendants. But I have to say this isn't problem-free. There are serious bottlenecks in magistrates' courts too, particularly the availability of the legal advisers and the probation officers that are needed to support magistrates. And that creates, you know, delays and cancellations that are very frustrating in magistrates' courts as well. So it does need to go together with more court resources. But we do think this could be a sensible move, and it could help to speed up justice and deal with the logjam that we have, particularly in the Crown Courts.
Tom Franklin, thank you for explaining it to us. Chief Executive of the Magistrates Association there.
Time now, 11 minutes to 7. The UN's most senior official overseeing aid in Gaza has been talking to the BBC, in fact to our international correspondent, Lise Doucette. And Lise is on the line. Good morning to you.
Good morning. And just for some context, you know, from the beginning of the Gaza war, ensuring that civilians got medical care, got food, has been a growing worry. So last December, they appointed a kind of humanitarian czar to oversee the situation. They chose Sigrid Kaag. She's a former deputy prime minister of the Netherlands, someone who first worked on Israeli-Palestinian issues 30 years ago. And the UN resolution, which established her job, talked about the urgent need for safe, rapid, unhindered delivery of aid. But the UN figures for August on how many trucks were reaching Gaza were still only around 70 trucks a day. But Israeli officials continue to say there's enough food in Gaza, that there is no starvation. So when I spoke to Sigrid Kaag, I said to her, well, what will be your main message to the UN Security Council today?
My main message is of a very somber and perhaps dark nature, that humanitarian conditions in Gaza, as well documented and reported, are akin to a significant catastrophe, that we've built all systems to be in place, but there's no substitute for political will and the political choice to improve matters. The ceasefire and release of the hostages is desperately needed. Not much else can be improved until we reach that point.
Is the UN failing the people of Gaza?
It's too easy to say we're failing. What we are doing collectively, I would say, as an international community, is we are failing the innocent civilians in Gaza. And that comes out of the political environment. The UN is working around the clock. The so-called enabling environment in Gaza is actually counter to anything else we've witnessed in other places. It's highly unsafe.
So let's look at the political environment. For example, the British Foreign Secretary, David Lammy, said he has repeatedly and forcefully raised his concerns with Israeli officials. He said, regrettably, they have not been addressed satisfactorily. Have your concerns been addressed satisfactorily?
My mission has constructive discussions. We put asks on the table. Some of them are met. We also obtain commitments. But between the commitment and the time that it takes to actually seek and see visible and tangible implementation, too much time passes. There is not a day, not a second to lose.
But it's month after month, as you know, it's just getting worse. So your mandate is failing?
The only metric that matters is change in the well-being, in the conditions of people on the ground.
But that is getting worse, the well-being of the people of Gaza?
We can't say that aid hasn't gotten in, but it's insufficient. It is not broad enough in the scope of goods people need. Systems are in place and these are functioning, but in nowhere does it meet the totality of needs. And these needs are an expression of rights. These are fundamental human rights.
Israeli officials tell us that one of the main reasons for the aid shortage is that Hamas is stealing the aid, which means the United Nations is not controlling it. Is that the issue?
We hear that a lot. I find that very difficult to confirm. I know that our colleagues, the different UN organizations, are working, they're distributing, they're monitoring, they're securing the assistance and through their operations and partners and actually making sure it reaches people. I can't say that everything goes right all the time. This is a war zone. But I can vouch for the integrity of the operations of our colleagues, of our teams.
You are one of the few senior UN officials who meets senior Israeli officials, including Prime Minister Netanyahu. How does he explain to you why more trucks are not going in? Why Gaza is on the brink of famine, if not already in famine?
I don't have the habit to comment publicly on what I discuss in closed-door meetings. But what is important is that we are very clear on our asks and our observations. When it comes to rising levels of malnutrition, the fact that the largest percentage of civilians in Gaza are food insecure, the difficulties we encounter, these are serious discussions, and we share our observations, our asks, and we continue to press on the follow-up.
That was Sigrid Karg of the UN talking to our international correspondent, Lise Doucette.
6 minutes to seven. Hugh Edwards, for so long the face of BBC News, will be back in court today after he admitted making indecent photographs of children on his last appearance in court. It will be an uncomfortable day, not just for him, not just for his alleged victims, but also for the BBC. Watching will be Katie Razzle, our media and culture editor. Do we know what we can expect to see, to hear in court today, Katie?
Well, Nick, I think we aren't expecting for Hugh Edwards to be sent to prison. These are serious offences, as you say, with real victims, children who have been abused and really have experienced the worst of humanity. Seven of the images that Hugh Edwards was sent were the most serious classification, Category A, with two clips of children aged 7 to 9. But the person who sent him those images got a suspended sentence when he was up in court. And it's likely Hugh Edwards will too, although, of course, we can never say for certain until it happens.
You've written a long, a thoughtful and interesting piece on BBC News Online about what lessons can be learned from this whole affair. What do you think are the remaining questions for people who run not just BBC News, but the BBC as a whole?
Well, I think there are still questions around payment. They have asked Hugh Edwards to repay £200,000 paid to him in the 5 months between when he was arrested and when he resigned. And I think there are still questions about whether it was an error to continue to pay him after a very small but core senior team were told by the police that he had been arrested. Now, they were asked to keep it confidential. And I do understand there are arguments, I've had them advanced to me by many, you know, human resources people and lawyers around the balancing act that the BBC was going through at that point, because it was balancing a sort of duty of care and legal responsibilities to an employee with wider reputational damage. And they were being told, you know, they must keep paying him. But only last week, Tim Davie, the Director General, in front of a select committee in the House of Lords, did question whether the BBC could have been more muscular. And if you think about it, you know, they did know, this core team, that these were serious Category A offences. Now, I think, you know, so that means that other people, including senior people I've spoken to at the BBC, believe they should have stopped paying that salary and that his contract would not have protected him if he'd fought it. But my understanding is, because of the context in which this Hugh Edwards story had developed or had originated, completely unrelated to the criminality that was involved in this case, you know, the Sun story, which didn't involve criminality, but was about somebody who started when they were just 17 years old, sorry. So the BBC people just did not conceive that the images involved younger children. But I think there are wider questions, of course, around judgment, you know, what was known about Hugh Edwards before all this. This is a man entrusted with announcing the death of the Queen. Had they done enough due diligence into him? We don't know what happened in the disciplinary process that happened after the Sun story appeared and when he was suspended, because it's never been published. I'm told that is normal in organisations, but some staff I've spoken to are furious about it. And I suppose the BBC would say, if they looked into every single person who was involved in the BBC, would we really want that kind of organisation where people were trawling, teams trawling through people's social media?
There is this old-fashioned thing called the news we've got to get to at the top of the hour. Katie Razzle, thank you for bringing that to us.
Before that, at 3 minutes to seven, the weather, equally important. Helen Willett, morning.
Good morning, and I'll go through quickly because the main issue this morning is fog. High pressure's coming to sit across the UK for the week ahead. So lots of dry weather, plenty of sunshine, warmer by day than it has been through the past week, quite chilly by night. So the fog problems this morning, mainly across parts of northwest England, through the North Midlands, or in fact through the Midlands and into the northeast of Wales. For the south of England, still a little bit of misty, drizzly weather that we've had from yesterday's weather system. That's clearing. So for England, Wales, plenty of sunshine. But this fog is really quite dense if you're travelling, particularly on the fast route. Excuse my voice this morning. 18 to 20. So temperatures leaping up after that chilly start. And it's a similar story for Scotland and Northern Ireland. It's really quite chilly to start here. Temperatures down to 2 or 3 degrees. Little bits of mist and fog around to watch out for as well. But again, the story for the day, the weather picture for the day, is one of plenty of sunshine coming through and warmth. 18 to 20 degrees Celsius, just a little cloud in the northwest later.
Thanks, Helen. Time now to discover what's reopening this morning.
Cafe Hope on BBC Radio 4.
By the time I'd finished these 100 meetings, I'd raised £50,000.
I'm Rachel Burden, welcoming you into a virtual coffee shop where I chat to people looking to improve the lives of those around them.
It's about tackling isolation and loneliness.
Engaging in conversation with people, you know, can make a massive difference.
Amazing individuals trying to make the world a better place.
I don't want anything for it. I'm doing it because I'm a volunteer.
The new series of Cafe Hope on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds, starting this morning at 9:45.
In the next hour on this programme, that assassination attempt, as it appears to be, the second one on Donald Trump. What should we make of it? What impact, if any, will it have on American politics? Plus, the Liberal Democrat conference begins today.
You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4. Good morning. It's 7 o'clock on Monday, the 16th of September. This is Today with Justin Webb in London and Nick Robinson in Ipswich. The headlines this morning, US Secret Service agents appear to have foiled an assassination attempt on Donald Trump as he was playing golf in Florida. So Keir Starmer will discuss Italy's approach to illegal migration when he holds talks in Rome as he faces pressure to do more to stop small boat crossings. The Scottish Government is close to agreeing a deal to host the Commonwealth Games in Glasgow in 2026. The BBC News is read this morning by Charles Carroll.
The US Secret Service has thwarted a suspected assassination attempt on Donald Trump while he was playing golf at his resort in Florida. The former president was rushed to safety when agents spotted an assault rifle aimed towards the course. A suspect has been arrested. In a statement, Mr. Trump said he was safe and well, but this appears to have been the second attempt on his life in a matter of months. Our North America editor, Sarah Smith, reports from West Palm Beach.
Donald Trump was only about 300 to 500 yards away when Secret Service agents spotted the barrel of a rifle poking through some bushes on the perimeter of the golf course and opened fire. As Mr. Trump was rushed to safety, the suspect fled the scene in a car. A witness took pictures of the vehicle and the license plate, and a man was later arrested. He has been named in US media as 58-year-old Ryan Wesley Routh. An assault rifle and scope, along with two backpacks and a GoPro camera, were later found at the scene. At a news conference, the Palm Beach County Sheriff Rick Bradshaw praised Mr. Trump's security team.
The Secret Service agent that was on the course did a fantastic job. What they do is they have an agent that jumps one hole ahead of time to where the president was at. And he was able to spot this rifle barrel sticking out of the fence and immediately engage that individual, at which time the individual took off.
BBC Verify has seen social media posts apparently from the suspect, which suggest he was involved in efforts to get foreign fighters into Ukraine. Former President Trump's Secret Service detail has been increased since he was shot at a rally in Pennsylvania just over 2 months ago. But there will still be questions about how someone was able to get so close to him with such a powerful weapon. In an email to supporters, Mr. Trump said his resolve was only stronger after another attempt on his life. "Nothing will slow me down," he added. "I will never surrender."
Sir Keir Starmer is expected to discuss how the UK could follow Italy in dramatically reducing the number of migrant crossings when he holds talks with the country's Prime Minister, Giorgia Meloni, later today. The two will meet in Rome as part of Sir Keir's wider bid to reset Britain's relationship with Europe. But immigration is likely to be high on the agenda a day after 8 migrants died when their boat capsized while trying to cross the Channel. Our political correspondent, Alex Forsyth, is travelling with the Prime Minister.
Sir Keir Starmer hopes to learn from Italy, which has seen the number of migrants crossing from North Africa fall by more than 60% in the past year. Financial deals with Tunisia and Libya to strengthen border security are seen to be key. And Italy has also agreed a plan with Albania to process asylum claims, something the Prime Minister's confirmed he's interested in. But the Italian approach hasn't been without controversy, with human rights groups among those expressing concern. With more than 23,000 people having crossed the channel so far this year, the government's conscious of the need for progress. After scrapping the Rwanda scheme, the focus has been on disrupting people smuggling gangs. And now Martin Hewitt, a former chair of the National Police Chiefs Council, has been named as the head of the new Border Security Command. The Conservatives claim Labour is posturing with no real plan.
Magistrates in England and Wales could be given powers to hand down longer custodial sentences under proposals to help reduce the backlog in Crown Courts and to cut the number of prisoners on remand. Ministers are considering a change in the law to double the maximum punishment handed out for a single offence from 6 to 12 months. More details from our political correspondent, Joe Pike.
Magistrates can currently jail criminals for up to 6 months for a single offence. By increasing that to a year, they will be able to try more serious crimes. In turn, that could reduce the backlog of cases in Crown Courts and also reduce the number of prisoners on remand, those waiting for trial who have not been convicted or sentenced. At the end of June, there were a record 17,000 prisoners on remand in England and Wales, representing a fifth of the prison population. In response to the proposals first reported by the Daily Telegraph, a Ministry of Justice spokesperson said the new government inherited prisons on the point of collapse and long-term options are being considered.
An independent commission is to begin its hearing into alleged breaches of the Premier League's financial rules by Manchester City. The club denies any wrongdoing but could be fined, deducted points or even relegated if found guilty by the three-person panel. Here's our sports editor, Dan Rowan.
One of the biggest legal disputes in the history of English football has reached a pivotal stage. A private 10-week hearing is finally set to start today, 18 months after Manchester City were accused by the Premier League of allegedly breaking the rules of the competition that they've won for a record-breaking 4 consecutive seasons. The independent commission must decide on a catalogue of 115 charges spread across 14 seasons after the club's Abu Dhabi takeover in 2008 transformed its fortunes. They include allegations that City subverted rules that limit a club's spending by failing to provide accurate financial information over sponsorship revenue, along with full details for manager and player payments. City are also accused of not cooperating with an investigation. The club strongly denies any wrongdoing, and it's said that its case is supported by a comprehensive body of irrefutable evidence.
The Scottish Government is understood to be on the verge of agreeing a deal for the 2026 Commonwealth Games to be held in Glasgow. The event had been due to be held in the Australian state of Victoria, but the bid was withdrawn because of rising costs. From Glasgow, Katrina Renton reports.
The state of Victoria in Australia, which was due to host the 2026 Games, pulled out in July last year, saying the costs outweighed the benefits. It was suggested Glasgow could rescue the event with a scaled-back version, but there were concerns that this would carry a reputational risk as well as a financial one. However, on Friday, the Australian authorities promised a multi-million pound investment to help Glasgow go ahead. It is also understood that the Scottish Government believes it has assurances from the UK Government that it won't have to dip into the public purse. The Commonwealth Games Federation has already pledged £100 million, and the rest will be funded by private income.
Primary school numbers in London are predicted to fall by 52,000 pupils in the next 5 years, double the rate of the rest of England. The analysis of government data has been carried out for this programme by the think tank the Education Policy Institute. It says the drop is down to a combination of falling birth rates, the cost of housing and the rising cost of living. Louis Hodge from the Institute says that fewer pupils will bring financial challenges for schools.
Given that funding is predominantly allocated to schools based on the number of pupils they have, means that budgets are likely to fall in many schools over the coming period. And given that many of the costs that schools face are fixed, a teacher still has to be paid for, that classroom still has to be heated, it means we could be seeing particularly squeezed budgets.
The Department for Education says it's increased school funding in England to almost £62 billion this year and is looking to repurpose empty school classrooms to create new nurseries. Shogun, the historical TV epic set in Japan, has made history at the Emmy Awards in Los Angeles, becoming the first foreign language series to win the Best Drama Prize. Another of the night's big winners was the hugely popular but highly contentious British TV hit Baby Reindeer. The Scottish comedian Richard Gadd took home three trophies for writing, producing and starring in the Netflix series, which is said to have been inspired by his real-life experience. As he accepted one of his awards, he said that this was the stuff of dreams.
I never ever thought I'd get my life together. I never ever thought I'd be able to rectify myself with what had happened to me and get myself back on my feet again. And then here I am, just over a decade later, picking up one of the biggest writing awards in television, yeah? Now, I don't mean that. I don't mean that to sound arrogant. I mean it as encouragement for anyone who's going through a difficult time right now to persevere.
And the American musician Tito Jackson, one of the original members of the Jackson 5, has died. He was 70. Along with his four brothers, he helped the band become a global cultural phenomenon during the 1970s and 80s.
Charles, thank you. It's 9 minutes past seven. It has happened again. A man with a rifle has got close enough to former President Donald Trump to be able to assassinate him. This time the suspect was spotted before they could fire a shot, from a bush alongside Trump's golf course in Florida. After the suspect was arrested fleeing from the scene, Palm Beach County Sheriff Rick Bradshaw spoke about the difficulties the Secret Service faced securing the course.
Well, you got to understand, the golf course is surrounded by shrubbery, so when somebody gets into the shrubbery, they're pretty much out of sight. All right? And at this level that he is at right now, he's not the sitting president. If he was, we would have had this entire golf course around it. But because he's not, the security is limited to the areas that the Secret Service deems possible.
Our North America editor Sarah Smith told me what we know about the suspect, who was arrested after Secret Service agents spotted a rifle poking out of a bush.
The suspect, Ryan Routh, seems to have been a fairly prolific poster on social media about political issues. Our colleagues at BBC Verify have been taking a look at some of his accounts. Interestingly, he does say he actually voted for Donald Trump in 2016, but seems to have become quite quickly disenchanted and most recently pretty obsessed with the conflict in Ukraine, trying to recruit people to go and fight on Ukraine's side in that war, talking a great deal about this. But digging into his background as well, it does appear he has been in trouble with law enforcement in the past as well. He seems to have been living in North Carolina most recently, where there have been traffic offences, but also an arrest for the illegal possession of a weapon. So this is somebody who, I mean, certainly wasn't on the radar to do something like this, but is not unknown to the police.
Spotted, we think, by a Secret Service agent hiding in a bush on a golf course.
Yeah, so he was, we think, in the shrubbery on the perimeter of the golf course where you can get to from the road. And what the Secret Service agent saw was the barrel of a rifle sticking out from the bushes. And these Secret Service agents were one hole ahead on the golf course than Donald Trump. So he was about 300, 500 yards away. As soon as they saw the rifle poking out, they fired at the suspect, who then took off without, as far as we understand it, firing a shot himself into a car and away. And when it was eventually stopped about 60 miles or so away by traffic police. It's remarkable that he could have gotten that close to Donald Trump. I mean, within shooting distance, basically, with a pretty high-powered weapon. So there will be big questions for the Secret Service to answer about this one as well. But I think it's going to come down to a row about resourcing, where they're likely to turn around and say they simply have not been given a big enough detail around former President Trump to do something like secure a whole golf course, even though they're meant to now have more resources than they did when that last assassination attempt took place 2 months ago in Pennsylvania.
If he were president, for the serving president, you would expect the whole of that to be completely zoned off, wouldn't you?
Yeah, and the local sheriff did actually say in a news conference, look, you know, we can only do so much with limited resources, but if it was the sitting president, if President Biden had been playing around on that golf course, the entire area would have been cleared and secured. You've been in these presidential events, Nick, just as have I, and it's astonishing just quite how many people get involved in securing enormous large areas. So although President Trump supposedly has more resources in his team now, I think this is something that his people are likely to get quite agitated about in the days to come. But statements from both President Biden and Vice President Harris this evening have said that they want to make sure all resources that are required to properly secure former President Trump will be in place.
Sarah Smith, our North America editor in West Palm Beach, thank you.
30 minutes past seven, and listening to her was Robert McDonald, who is a senior member of the Secret Service, or was. Indeed, he was supervisor of President Biden's security detail when he was vice president, and Mr. McDonald is on the line now. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Justin. Thank you for having me.
Well, thank you for coming on. What do you make of what's happened? Was this the Secret Service acting well and doing the best they could under these circumstances, or something else, do you think?
No, I think as compared to July 13th, where the Secret Service had some epic failures in its policies and protocols, this was a very positive reaction by the Secret Service. The Secret Service agent that was out a hole ahead in the Secret Service bubble, if you will, around the former president was able to diligently spot this individual and then make sure that the protective measures directly around the former president were enhanced. Now, the Secret Service usually would not go after that person. That was done by other law enforcement agencies that the Secret Service works in concert with. The Secret Service is mainly concerned with the individual protection of the former president there. So all around, I think it was a good day for the Secret Service, despite this individual getting relatively close again.
It was interesting to hear someone saying there to Sarah Smith that actually if Donald Trump was president, there would be much more protection. And you do wonder, don't you, whether, given the level of threats, obviously against him, but also potentially against Kamala Harris as well, whether the same level of security shouldn't now be given for both of them as candidates.
Well, you're absolutely right. You know, the former president is not our normal former president in the United States. He's out running for office again. He's very recognizable. He's very controversial. So he brings a different level of interest than a former President Clinton or a former President Bush, who may go out and do book signings or may go out and do speeches now, but in a relatively low-key fashion. So I'm guessing that the Secret Service over the last 8 weeks, I hope, has retooled itself, refitted itself, allowed itself to provide more and more assets to the former president as we move into the home stretch of the presidential election season in the United States.
Because the risk is copycats, isn't it, as this may well have been. And you look back to the late 60s and the early 70s, and these things go in spasms, in spates, don't they?
That's exactly right, Justin, that, you know, copycat people now are exactly who we're worried about. They see now that over the last 8 weeks, two people have gotten relatively close to the former president with high-powered rifles and were able to potentially cause damage. Thankfully, so far, the injuries and whatnot have been minimal. But as we move forward, obviously, the bigger concern now is somebody going to get a tiny bit closer? Is somebody going to have another high-powered rifle? And is somebody going to be able to inflict some serious damage?
Robert McDonald, thank you very much.
Thank you.
It is now 16 minutes past seven. Should Britain learn from Italy how to stop the boats bringing migrants to our shores? Giorgia Meloni, who's been Italy's prime minister for almost 2 years, was elected on a promise to use the Navy to blockade the routes carrying migrants from North Africa to Italy's southern coast. It was a promise she was widely condemned for making and indeed never actually carried out. But since then, the numbers crossing the Mediterranean have dropped significantly. And it's something she's going to be discussing with Keir Starmer, who is in Rome today. Let us talk now to a member of Giorgio Meloni's Brothers of Italy party, Gian Giacomo Calovini, who is a member of the Foreign Affairs Committee of the Italian Parliament. Morning to you, and thank you for joining us. What do you think does explain the success of the Meloni government in cutting the numbers so substantially?
Good morning, and thank you for your question. First of all, I want to say that the issue of illegal immigrants is for our government, my government in Italy, one of the most important priorities. And I hope and I think and I believe that after maybe tomorrow afternoon at the meeting between our prime minister, we have to try to face in this problem together, even if we have now two different governments. But if I can tell you something about Italy, I have to tell you that we, in just the last 6 months, we have 65% less of arrival. From the 1st of January in the 2023, arrive in Italy 62,000 migrants. And in the last 6 months, in 2024, just 25,000. Why? Because we are doing many agreements with many countries in North Africa. And at the same time, because we bring this problem to the Brussels table with the other countries. So we think that if we work all together in Europe and if we have some agreement with this country in North Africa, we can do very well for this big problem.
Mr. Calavini, it's interesting that you identify the deals with Tunisia, which was the biggest source of migrants crossing the Mediterranean, and Libya alongside as the key. Because some people say it is because Giorgia Meloni has been so hostile to the rescue of migrants in the Channel, controversially frustrating the NGO boats that go to rescue the migrants, sending them many, many hundreds of miles away from the scenes that they want to be in to drop people off, and it is argued by some making that journey more dangerous.
Yes, it's correct, but we know very well about these problems, or the problem of human rights, for example, in many countries in Africa. But at the same time, we have to remember that until today, many migrants, if they want to arrive in Italy or in Europe, they have to pay more or less 3,000, 4,000 euros or US dollars to leave the North Africa. And they have to pay to the some people, some criminals that they manage the trade of migrants. It, for us, is unacceptable. And at the same time, we have to remember that arrive here in Italy or Europe with unsafe and terrible boat, and many times they lose their lives in the Mediterranean. So we have to stop this unacceptable trade of migrants. And at the same time, we have to ask to this kind of country in Africa to respect the human rights.
And how important is the processing of migration claims in Albania? It's rather different from the Conservative government's Rwanda scheme, but it does involve processing asylum claims, at least, outside Italy, in another country, Albania. How significant do you think that has been?
It's very different from your idea with Rwanda, because in Albania we are building just two big hubs for the migrants. And in this hub, the asylum application is managed by Italian legislation. So there is no doubt about the respect of human rights. And there is more. Until now, many migrants arrive in Italy in a little island, I think you know, like Lampedusa or Pantelleria, beautiful island, perfect for tourism. But it's unacceptable that they arrive there because we have no space to bring in some building and check if they can come here in Europe. So if we are able to bring them in this new building in Albania, probably we can check in a new building if they can really come, if they really can stay here in Italy and in Europe. So probably it's better, not only for us, but probably it's better for them.
Well, we will see what comes out of that meeting between your Prime Minister and our Prime Minister, Gian Giacomo Calavini from Italy. Thank you very much indeed. And we'll be discussing that with Home Secretary at about 10 past 8.
21 minutes past 7 is the time now. House prices often rise in September. This September, though, they are doing so much faster than usual. Let's hear again from Sean.
Yes, Justin, this is the Right Move House Price Index. So it's a big sample of asking prices. And they were up 0.8% from August to September. That's twice as fast as the long-term average. Tim Bannister is the Director of Property Science at Right Move. Hi, Tim.
Good morning.
Why are sellers keener to ask for more this September?
Well, I think we've seen people come back from the summer holidays sort of invigorated a little, really wanting to get on and move. You know, I think at the beginning of the year, we have seen things, you know, a couple of the sort of big unknowns have been removed. So we had, you know, the election hanging over us, that earlier than expected, and obviously with a big majority. And we were all waiting to see when that first rate cut would be from the Bank of England. Obviously, that's happened now. That happened back in August. And, you know, removing some of those uncertainties has improved sentiment. And we've seen that reflected in demand. Demand's up 15% compared to where we were last year. Supply's up a little bit, so some confidence, people bringing stock to market. And critically, that activity is turning into sales. So sold subject to contract, that sales being agreed, that's up 27% compared to where we were last year. So right. It does seem that there's some positive sentiment at the moment.
We've got a budget at the end of next month. Are you seeing any changes specific to certain potential tax changes, possible increase in capital gains tax for landlords, for example?
Yeah, it's always difficult to pin it exactly on that. But, you know, obviously that news around capital gains tax perhaps might change particular segments in the market. We have seen a few more properties on the landlord side of things, like typical first-time buyer type properties, properties that landlords might be owning, that they were coming through a little bit more supply coming through there. And then actually more recently, we've seen some of those larger properties, so perhaps properties that people were owners, second homes, coming to market, perhaps with one eye on capital gains tax, trying to get those sold perhaps before any changes might occur, which might impact the profit somebody might make if they had a second home or a property to rent.
Would a capital gains tax be an increase in it be good for renters or not, Tim? I just see there's a report picked up in a few of the papers from Hampton's estate agents today that the gap in rents between the north and the south of England is the smallest for 11 years. I just wonder what's going on there.
Yeah, well, I suppose in rental, we have seen rental prices, particularly through 21, 22, into early parts of 2023, were moving very, very quickly. It's always been difficult for tenants. It's always been difficult to find a home. There's been this gap between supply and demand that has been closing a little bit. So demand's been coming off, perhaps because where prices have been getting to and the pace of price growth, there's been falling a little bit, and we've seen stock coming onto the market. So a bit more supply compared to where we were in those very stock starved periods. Mm. But we want to see more of that. So we need to see, London prices they're still going up, but they're coming up at not double digit growth anymore. So there is that gap closing a little bit, and particularly when London's slowing down a little bit. Tim. But, you know, capital gains tax has meant that perhaps we might see some stock leaving the market, which I don't think is actually that great for tenants.
Tim Bannister, thank you from Rightmove.
Thank you, Sean. 25 minutes past seven now. At a time when so many British Jews are frightened and anxious, at a time when so many are watching daily for news of friends and family in Israel, the reporting of the country's leading Jewish newspaper, the Jewish Chronicle, really matters. Three prominent columnists for the paper resigned over the weekend in protest after the paper was forced to delete a series of articles with highly contentious claims which simply couldn't be substantiated and which the columnists believe were fabricated to help support arguments being made by Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. We're joined by one of the columnists who resigned, Hadley Freeman. Good morning to you, Hadley. For people who've not followed any of this argument, what drove you to resign? What was so serious about the claims made in these articles?
Well, like any journalist, I'm not going to agree with everything my publication publishes. And that was the case with the Jewish Chronicle. There had always been articles I disagreed with and management decisions I disagreed with. But as you said, there were a series of articles published by someone whose name was Elon Perry, which made wild claims, to be honest, that the IDF made the unusual step of saying they could not find any evidence for these claims, that Israeli hostages were on the verge of being smuggled out of the country. And ultimately, the Jewish Chronicle stepped in and deleted the articles from the site. But for a bunch of us, this was too little too late, and we felt that there had not been editorial standards applied to this journalist because that journalist was adhering to an ideology that perhaps was similar to that of the editorial board. And so we resigned.
Yeah, this is the Israeli Defense Force failed to mm-hmm. back mm-hmm. up an article that suggested that Netanyahu was right to claim that strip of land to the south of Gaza mm-hmm. was absolutely crucial to him. Now, he says, Elon Perry, the journalist, I use that word in inverted commas, mm-hmm. that he was victim of a witch hunt against me caused by jealousy. Is this really a political row about what the Jewish Chronicle should stand for or should not stand for?
Well, what it stands for me is, you know, I joined the Jewish Chronicle, I think, about a year and a half ago as a monthly columnist because I strongly want there to be a mainstream national Jewish newspaper in this country that represents the plurality of views of Jews in this country. You know, Jews represent a tiny, tiny percentage of the British population, less than 1%. And we want to have a liberal, modern voice that represents British Jewish feelings. Most British Jews believe in a Jewish home state. We believe in a two-state solution, and we hope for peace in the Middle East. And what it felt like increasingly was that the Jewish Chronicle was representing a more ideological rather than strictly journalistic point of view and was becoming far more right-wing and far more in step with Netanyahu, which most British Jews, I would think it's fair to say, are not. And that is not why I wanted to join a British Jewish newspaper to represent the views of Netanyahu. I want to represent the views of British Jews. And it just became a point where I couldn't stay.
Now, the editor says that it's the worst nightmare of every newspaper editor to be deceived by a journalist. He takes responsibility for it. But it seems to me there's a bigger battle going on here, isn't there? We don't actually know who owns the Jewish Chronicle. It was taken over by a mysterious consortium. One of the people who's the front man for it is, in fact, on the board of the BBC, Sir Robbie Gibb. But we don't know who's putting the money in, do we?
Yes, exactly. And this is something that I, along with other journalists at the Jewish Chronicle, have pushed the editor to reveal over the past months. I know Jonathan Friedman has spoken with Jake Wallace-Simmons. I've spoken with Jake Wallace-Simmons saying we need to have full transparency in order for there to be accountability. People can criticize many media owners in this country and abroad, but at least we know who those media owners are. If we don't know who they are at the Jewish Chronicle, there cannot be fair accountability.
Hadley Freeman, former columnist of the Jewish Chronicle. Thank you for talking to us.
29 minutes past seven to the Sport and Carthy.
Morning. Thank you very much. Football headlines to start. Arsenal are 2 points off Premier League leaders Manchester City after a 1-0 win over Tottenham. The Arsenal manager, Mikel Arteta, described the victory as one of his most important wins as they had key players missing for the game. Arsenal have now defeated Tottenham away for three seasons in a row. Newcastle are in third place after they came back from behind to beat Wolves at 2-1. And Manchester City's independent hearing, where they face 115 charges for allegedly breaching the Premier League's financial rules, starts today. We'll discuss that in the next hour. Rangers beat Dundee United 1-0 and they move to within 5 points of Celtic and Aberdeen, who are leading the Scottish Premiership. Golf, and despite a final day fight back by Europe, who are 10-6 down on Sunday, the USA won the Solheim Cup by 15.5 points to 12.5 points. The win ends the USA's seven-year Solheim Cup drought. I've been speaking to the BBC's golf correspondent Ian Carter, who's in Virginia, about Europe's reaction to what was a thrilling finish to the competition.
I think their reaction was mixed. Obvious disappointment that they have now coughed up the Solheim Cup and it's back in American hands for the first time since 2017. There will be an element of relief that they made it competitive on the final day, because for much of the first 2 days it was very much uncompetitive. I think Stacey Lewis had Suzanne Pettersson's number pretty much throughout the match, but those players that had been perhaps marginalised by Europe really came up trumps. Leona Maguire winning her match, the way that Celine Boutier came through to beat Lexi Thompson, and it did turn into an absolute thriller. So those European players will know that they were part of something very special, but there will be overriding frustration that they have been beaten by America, and once again that trophy is back in US hands.
And where did the standout individual performances come from on the final day?
Well, they came from the United States. I mean, there was a brilliant performance from Charlie Hull, make no mistake, in beating Nelly Korda, the world number one, 6-4. But Korda had done the damage on the first 2 days there. Georgia Hall for Europe as well, with her 4-3 win over Alison Lee. But you look at the overall contribution of Rose Zhang, winning all four of her matches. On debut, Lauren Coughlin in her home state of Virginia, winning 3.5 points out of four and helping get the Americans over the line with that half against Maya Stark when it was getting really, really tense. Those were massive contributions. And you also have to give credit to the world number two, Lilia Vu, with the birdie on 17, a lengthy putt there, and then a brilliant approach to birdie the 18th. Make sure that she escaped with a half a point against Alban Valenzuela, and that was the half point that ultimately took them to the magic number of 14.5 points.
Ian Carter in Virginia there. Rory McIlroy admitted he is getting used to near misses after he led by four strokes yesterday at the Irish Open, but finished in second place to Rasmus Højgaard, who won by just one shot at Royal County Down. Cricket, and Ireland women beat England by 5 wickets to draw the two-match series. England and Australia's T20 men's series, though, ended in a draw after the third match was washed out by rain. And Oscar Piastri won Formula One's Azerbaijan Grand Prix. McLaren teammate Lando Norris finished in fourth place. He moves to 59 points behind championship leader Max Verstappen, with just 7 races left this season.
Carthy, thank you very much.
This is the shocking moment English football has been dreading.
My name is Moses Swebu, and I used to be a professional footballer. But then I got in deep with organised crime and became a match fixer operating in the English league.
A match fixing investigator has highlighted 2 matches he says appear to have suspicious betting patterns.
How honest are you going to be with me?
This is 100%. Join me for Sports Strangest Crimes presents Confessions of a Match Fixer. Listen on BBC Sounds.
And to the weather, which is expected to be largely dry today. Plenty of sunshine, turning even warmer.
Nice here in East Anglia today. You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Justin Webb in London, Nick Robinson in Ipswich at 27 minutes to 8. Charles Carroll has a summary of the news.
The US Secret Service has foiled a suspected assassination attempt on Donald Trump while he was playing golf at his resort in Florida. The former president was rushed to safety when agents spotted an assault rifle aimed towards the course. A man has been arrested and has been named in the US media as Ryan Routh, a 58-year-old from Hawaii. The White House said President Biden was relieved to hear the former president was safe, while Mr. Trump's Democratic rival in November's election, Kamala Harris, said there was no room for violence in US politics. Sir Keir Starmer has said he's interested in learning about Italy's scheme to send migrants rescued at sea to Albania to process their asylum claims. He's in Rome to hold talks with the Italian Prime Minister, Giorgia Meloni. The Prime Minister is facing renewed pressure to rethink the UK's immigration policies after 8 migrants died while trying to cross the Channel yesterday. Magistrates in England and Wales could be given powers to jail criminals for longer under government plans. By trying more serious offences and handing down longer sentences, ministers hope magistrates' courts could help to bring down the backlog at Crown Courts and ease prison overcrowding. A hearing will begin today into allegations that Manchester City breached the Premier League's financial rules 115 times between 2009 and 2018. The club denies any wrongdoing but could be fined, deducted points, or even relegated if found guilty. The American musician Tito Jackson, one of the original members of the Jackson 5, has died at the age of 70. Along with his 4 brothers, he helped the band become a global cultural phenomenon during the 1970s and 80s, with hits including I Want You Back and ABC. And the Japanese historical epic Shogun has won the prestigious Best Drama Award at the Emmys in Los Angeles, becoming the first foreign language film to a television show to take the top prize. Hacks won Best Comedy Series, while its main rival The Bear took home 3 of the 4 awards for comedy acting. Baby Reindeer, the chilling British TV hit about a bartender stalked by a customer, won 3 trophies for its creator Richard Gadd and 1 for his co-star Jessica Gunning.
Thank you, Charles. It's 25 minutes to 8 now. All this week, we're going to be looking at stories that have been brought to us by listeners who wanted to be guest editors of the programme. Today, it's the turn of parent governors at a secondary school in South London, Vanessa and Toby, who, when they applied to the Today programme, called their idea the Ballad of the Disappearing Children, because they'd noticed that far fewer children and families were living where they lived in South London. Exclusive research for the programme, carried out as a result of that story idea, has shown that primary school numbers have fallen by 5% in London in the last 5 years, and they're projected to continue falling at double the rate of the rest of England. In Southwark, where our listeners live, 4 primary schools have closed in the last 2 years alone. Our correspondent Harry Farley went there to meet them.
For here or takeaway?
For here, thank
Thank you very much.
You would have cousins and, you know, grandmothers and things at the school gate. And that's going because a lot of those people are being priced out.
10 years down the line, it's the ripples that come out from gentrification that aren't really noticed.
I'm talking to Toby and Ness in an upmarket coffee shop. Oat milk, cappuccinos and almond croissants and the like. It's part of a new development of luxury flats called Elephant Park in South London. They've lived here for more than 20 years, and as we leave the cafe, Ness describes how their home has changed.
This used to be the Haygate Estate, a very famous, huge estate. So here we've got some very nice restaurants and cafes. We've got greenery. You'll see that there's quite a lot of dogs, because a lot of the people that are moving in, they might not have children, but they do get a dog.
Tell us why you got in touch with the Today programme.
Because we've noticed how with regeneration, and then certainly since the pandemic and cost of living going up, that the numbers of children around here seem to be decreasing. And we know from being school governors of a multi-academy trust that the number of admissions has reduced at secondary schools, and that is the case throughout Southwark and other boroughs nearby.
So what do you see as the problem then, Toby?
What's happened here is there's been demolition of huge amounts of, you know, older council estates and housing estates. We're standing now in one of those new developments, and you go from a mixed society of you know, young and old people and rich and poor to a kind of mono society where everybody is of a similar type. It's all, you know, young professionals between 25 and 45. What's been built here, I think, out of, you know, 2,000 flats, there's 18 of them are three-bed flats. So there's no provision for families in the area. And so, you know, 10 years after, you know, these housing estates are knocked down, there's no kids left. We wanted to ask whether children are being designed out of our inner cities.
Good morning, lovely uniform, well done, good morning.
Down the road in Peckham, the new term is getting underway at one of the Harris Academy schools. The CEO is Sudan Moynihan.
Stop touching.
Well, the impact of depopulation for us is we've had to merge two very successful primary schools into one. The other impact is teachers can't afford to live in the capital. We now recruit teachers from Jamaica simply because we cannot find teachers who are willing to work and live in central London.
How concerned are you about that trend of falling children in inner London boroughs?
I mean, I'm very concerned because the cause is that poorer, lower income families can't afford to live in the centre of our capital. And the problem is that housing costs are too high. I mean, cities are increasingly atomised and lonely places. A primary school playground is one of the few places where communities can come together and bond. And we're not just losing those centres of education, we're losing places of community where parents can come and talk to each other and talk to school staff to get help on a wide range of issues.
Back at Elephant Park, I called mother of two, Romy. She lives with her husband near here for now, but they're leaving London.
Hello.
Hi, Romy. It's Harry from the BBC.
Hi, Harry. How are you?
I'm all right, thanks. Thanks.
The reality of combining rental payments with childcare costs with two kids in nursery has been quite expensive. Whilst in the meantime, just basically relying on savings to cover daily costs means that, you know, we just couldn't manage to keep up with London anymore, despite both having full-time jobs and, you know, actually I, you know, pretty decent salaries.
So we've moved to a different part of the estate and we're sat in front of a playground. There's a couple of kids playing on the slides, and I'm joined by Paul Swinney of the Centre for Cities think tank. Paul, you've been doing some analysis for us. Give us the top lines, give us the headlines from that.
We do know that birth rates across the UK are falling. We know they're falling a little bit sharper in London, but they're falling even sharper still in Southwark. So I think birth rates have fallen by about 10% in London over the last decade. In Southwark, it's been about 20%. So quite a big change in terms of the number of children that are being born here, and that clearly has implications then for things like school places, etc.
So it's not as simple as families are being forced out by house prices. There's also a bigger picture there.
It's definitely part of the story, and Romy, I think, summarised that very nicely. But there are other things that are going on too. Families clearly want something a bit different. They want a bit more space. They want space for their kids in particular, access to schools, green space. And different parts of cities are going to play those different roles. So we shouldn't expect, I think, the demographic to be exactly the same across cities, but we also shouldn't be expecting that families have to move out of London to find somewhere to live.
I've walked quite literally over the road from the newly built Elephant Park to the Rockingham Estate, and I'm surrounded by a series of red brick, four-storey 1930s blocks with fading purple paint on the balconies. Kenny Smith is 58, and he's lived here all his life.
Hi, Kenny.
Come in.
Hi, thanks for having us.
Growing up on the estate, I had lots of friends. Now, in regards to regentrification, when these people had to move, it was almost like it was overnight that I'd lost all my friends. One week it seemed like we had friends and neighbours. The next week it just seems like we had strangers. The consequence of that is that people growing up here now, they won't invest.
Tell us about the impact that has had on what it feels like to live here.
A detrimental effect. It's not a nice feeling living somewhere where you go outside the door and you feel like you don't know anyone.
It's a long time since Kenny grew up in Southwark, but for our Today listeners, Ness and Toby, their sons, Hector and Barney, are seeing the area change before their eyes.
My nursery that I went to is now gone, and the primary school that lots of my friends went to is also now gone, and it's now a creative workspace.
It's being remodelled, but it's like really like different now. It doesn't look the same at all, and it's like all new and like modern, and it's not as nice.
As for Ness and Toby, what do they think the solution is?
I think the solution is for developers to really put families at the forefront when they're coming into areas like ours. And I know it's not just happening here.
I would slightly disagree with Ness in that I think that you can't expect the private sector, the for-profit private sector, to meet the housing needs. And I think we have planning guidelines that if you make developers build more family flats, you'll get more families. If you make them only build studios and one beds, that's what you'll get.
Harry Farley there talking to our listeners Toby and Vanessa with their choice of subject for us, and we're going to be speaking to the Education Policy Institute about falling pupil numbers in inner city areas after 8:30.
Time now, 16 minutes to 8. Best drama, best actor in a drama, best actress in a drama, best directing as well. The British-made Japanese historical drama Shogun, widely thought of potentially being able to sweep the Emmys in its nominated categories, and, well, it just about managed it. The series, which goes out on Disney+, hugely praised at the awards last night. I've been talking to its director, Jonathan von Tulleken, and I started by asking whether he was surprised.
I was surprised. I mean, when you set out to make something like this, you just hope you don't disappoint people. You know, the complexity of it and trying to ensure the authenticity of it and, you know, just to tell a really great story and do Justin Marks and Rachel Kondo's scripts justice and the original book justice. You know, that's, I think, what primarily concerns everyone. To get all the nominations then and then for it to actually win and sort of have this amazing sweep is kind of unbelievable, because it's definitely not what you set out with.
An amazing sweep and a history-making sweep, because it's the first non-English language series, isn't it, ever to win Best Drama.
Yeah, that says a lot about the TV environment we're in. I think it also was a huge roll of the dice from effects and Disney to really make sure it was, you know, lots in Japanese. I think it's sort of 70 or 80% in Japanese, and to really tell it from the Eastern gaze as opposed from the Western gaze. And I think that's what makes it so appealing as well.
Yeah, you say there's a new TV environment. Tell us more about that.
I just think people are more willing, you know, because of things like Squid Games, because of much more subtitled work out on TV. I think because people are looking to experiment and see things that take them out of their culture. You know, I think that's been going on for a couple of years now. And I think it did open the door for something like this, where, you know, Shogun really could do it all, you know, as much as is possible in another language. And I think people were really open to that.
And for someone who's been listening to us having this conversation but has never heard or seen anything of Shogun, tell us about it.
You know, it's a huge, sweeping epic set in 17th century feudal Japan. You know, it explores sort of loyalty, honor, power, all through the lens of both the Japanese players at the time who are vying for power, and also through the lens of a shipwrecked English pilot who's got to survive it by navigating this world as well as he survives the sea.
I've seen it compared to Game of Thrones, if only in kind of scope and extent and ambition.
Yeah, I think it is definitely Game of Thrones. I think it's got a bit of Succession thrown in there as well. It's got rich characters, complex characters. You know, it definitely doesn't, you know, patronize its audience. And it definitely has that huge epic scale that Game of Thrones brought as well, you know, and a very complex narrative, you know, sort of interweaving between all these different players.
And the British side of this, I mean, it wasn't the only successful show, was it? British TV, British drama,
yeah,
production
doing
really
well. Yeah, it's fantastic. I've worked for Clark & Well before, and it was incredible to see them do so well. You know, they did Misfits and things like that and End of the World. And yeah, it's just so nice to see, you know, British film industry doing well.
Yeah, The Crown, Slow Horses, etc.,
yeah,
etc.
It's
quite a long list,
well,
isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, they're really great, you know. And it's amazing to sort of feel like there is a real influence now coming out of England. A lot of stuff is filmed there as well now.
Jonathan van Tulleken, congratulations. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much indeed.
It is now 12 minutes to 8 and time for Thought for the Day. The speaker this morning, the Right Reverend Dr. David Walker, Bishop of Manchester.
Good morning. For once, Greater Manchester has been upstaged. It was two drivers from the West Midlands who joined teams from 21 other nations in Frankfurt this weekend to be the English competitors in the European Tram Driving Championships. I'm delighted that trams now have their own sporting competition. With almost 4 years before the next Olympic Games, who knows what the future may promise. Living in Salford, I use trams pretty often, as I do buses and trains. Not only are they greener and less stressful than urban driving, they're more sociable too. People talk. Most conversations may not be on matters of great consequence, but chatting about the weather, what the day ahead holds, or even sharing stories of some previous much-delayed journey warms my heart. I feel connected, part of a common humanity. I suspect similar reasoning lies behind the decision of a large academy trust this week to ban its pupils from using mobile devices at school. The Christian scriptures tell of how God, having sent many messages and messengers, and even inscribed key commandments on tablets of stone, takes another track. In Jesus, he meets with his creation face to face. The four Gospels give glimpses of what he and his companions talked about along the way, but I imagine them spending a lot of time simply building deeper relationships through casual conversation. I suspect it was that, as much as the content of Jesus' teaching, which held them together through that critical period, post-Easter and his ascension, when he was no longer with them in person. This time last week, I just landed back from Barbados. My weekend had been spent in meetings seeking to address the legacy of a church-based charity that had, until the late 1830s, derived much income from a sugar plantation which used enslaved Africans for its labour force. A significant sum has been set aside. My role is as part of a steering committee, both local and international, which will oversee how it should be spent. We need both to mark a dreadful past and to build a better future. Most of our meetings will, inevitably, take place online, but spending a weekend together on the actual plantation site proved vital in building our sense of common purpose and our trust for each other. So, if you're listening while struggling through the Monday morning commute, it might not feel like it, but it's probably worth it. Not because you'll work more efficiently than from home, but for the human contact you'll make. And if you're still agog to know who are the 2024 European Tram Driving Championships, maybe the sports news later in the programme will tell us.
That was Thought for the Day with the Right Reverend Dr. David Walker, the Bishop of Manchester, and it takes us to 10 to 8. It is Liberal Democrats conference time in Brighton. I'm ashamed to say earlier in the programme I said it started today, but of course it started on Saturday, the chance for the party to celebrate the 72 MPs, to think about what to do with its influence in Parliament as well. And Sir Ed Davey, the leader of the Liberal Democrats, who indeed arrived at the conference on a jet ski, so I really should have noticed that, shouldn't I, is on the line now. Morning, Sir Ed.
Good morning, Justin.
What are you saying to the nation today about who you are, what you represent?
Well, we're focusing on NHS and care, just like we did the general election. I think it's really important for a party that does so well and has a record number of MPs for over 100 years. We take forward the mandate, and that was on largely on health and care and obviously other issues like sewage and cost of living. But on NHS and care, there's no doubt our NHS system is in crisis. Social care has not been reformed. Family carers have not been supported, and they are our priority, and we're putting forward, I think, very realistic proposals, particularly to invest in primary care, in GPs, in NHS dentists and community pharmacists, because we think if you do that, it means people don't end up going to hospital so often. People can get that care more quickly in their community, and that's part of a sort of change in the way funding is allocated. And then we've got our social care reforms.
Yeah, so a wider point then about those and other policies you've got at the moment. Actually, a prominent Liberal Democrat texted me this morning saying our policies are a long list of things we should spend more money on. In other words, are you going to be opposing Labour, as it were, from the left? Is that where you have settled now as a party?
No, I don't think like that at all. I mean, I don't think the health service is a left-right issue, frankly. We want reforms, and we want to make sure those reforms work. I mean, other parties have talked about social care reform, for example, but they've not achieved it. Liberal Democrats have for quite a while actually led on the care issue, because we believe that if you get the care right, particularly for elderly people, but also for disabled people and so on, that takes pressure off the NHS. It's a reform that is urgently needed, so we get better care and we help the NHS. I don't see that as a left-right issue.
Are there any left-right issues where you are opposing Labour from the right?
Well, I mean, it depends on what you think on the economy. So, for example, let's take Europe. I welcome the fact that Keir Starmer has gone to Europe and is trying to rebuild the relationships after the appalling mess the Conservatives made of it and the loss of trust between the UK and our nearest European partners. So I welcome that. I just don't think it's going far enough. And if you want to see that left-right, I don't really see it that way. But if you're going to rebuild our economy and get growth, you have to go further than the Prime Minister is going. The fact that he's ruled out going back in the single market, I think, is a mistake for those negotiations and for the vision of getting more investment into our country, getting rid of all the red tape and regulations that the Conservatives brought in to exporters, so damaged our farmers and small businesses. So you probably won't be surprised that Liberal Democrats, as a pro-European party, as a pro-trade party, want to see a much greater urgency and ambition from the government on that.
I suppose the issue for you as a party is whether you find yourself in a place where you are opposing Labour, but not doing so from the perspective of the people who voted for you this time round in overwhelmingly Conservative seats, former Conservative seats, but might not want you to go to the places that you're tempted to go to. Do you understand, do you see that as a potential issue for the party?
I genuinely don't. I mean, we had hundreds of thousands, millions of conversations during the general election with people in those areas that we won from the Conservatives. And what was striking was we talked to a lot of people who'd been lifelong Conservatives, who'd completely lost faith in the Conservative Party. They felt the Conservative Party had moved away from respect for rule of law and order, for freedom, for decency, for compassion. And they saw those values really strong in the Liberal Democrats. And so I think we've seen a change on a shift to us on a values basis, which is quite profound. Mm. And then you add to that the fact that we've been taking issues which the Conservatives just took me for granted on, just didn't seem to care, completely out of touch on the NHS. And I, as I say to you, I think to take rural areas, I think we could be, we are the party now of rural Britain, because the rural health services have been decimated under the Conservatives. So again, I don't see that in the way you're caricaturing
it. Fair enough if you don't, although others do. Let me ask you a specific one, for instance, about foreign policy and this issue now of whether or not Britain allows Ukraine to use long-range missiles, British long-range missiles, against targets in Russia. Where do you stand on that?
Well, I think it's very important on an issue like this that you build consensus in the UK, across party, which we've held a lot on the Ukraine issue, and consensus with our allies, obviously the Americans. If I had a preference, we would absolutely be allowing President Zelensky and the Ukrainians to use our long-range missiles to attack Russian bases where they're hitting innocent Ukrainian civilians and the Ukrainian army from. And I would prefer that we'd go ahead and do that unilaterally. But there is this, I think, overriding issue of trying to take people with you, because what Moscow and the Kremlin needs to hear is unity, is consensus, because that's where we're really, really strong. Mm. And I just hope that the UK government is able to persuade the White House to move further than they appear to have done so far.
Sir Ed Davey, thank you very much.
3 minutes to eight, time for the weather. Helen Willits has got it for us.
Nick, thank you very much indeed. It's fine weather in prospect for most of us. I shouldn't say that too loudly, should I? Because high pressure is moving in for this week. But it's that time of year when you have the dilemma of what to wear. It's chilly in the morning, only 2 or 3 degrees above freezing in some parts of Scotland. So a big jumper or the coat. And by the afternoon, it's warm. So you're shedding the coat and the jumper as well. So something to pack with you when you're heading out. But the main issue you have today is fog. And fog at this time of year will linger until the middle of the morning. It's certainly causing issues on the roads around the northwest of England, the North Midlands, into the northeast of Wales, in fact, through much of the Midlands. So I'll start with England and Wales, because that will take some time before it finally clears away mid-morning. We're getting rid of the remnants of yesterday's weather front in the far south, just a little bit of drizzly rain and clouds sitting across the Channel Islands. That's clearing. Sunshine for all, and when the fog has gone, but as I say, it just takes a little time, and it uses up some of that sun's energy. So temperatures will be between 18 and 20 quite widely today, more widely than yesterday, and 21, 22 in the far southeast. For Northern Ireland, we've got a little bit of mist and fog as well to clear away, but plenty of sunshine already is with us, and it should stay dry with just fair weather cloud for much of the day, and temperatures after that chilly start up to, again, 18 to 20 degrees Celsius, as they will be across Scotland. The discrepancy here is that we will have a weather front coming into the far northwest later, just clouding the skies over, mostly dry until after dark. But after the early chilly start, a little bit of mist and fog around, Scotland too will enjoy a lot of dry and really quite sunny and warm weather. Temperatures lifting to between 17 and 18 degrees Celsius, I think, is the high.
Helen, thank you. Across this week, 5 shortlisted finalists will be coming to Radio 4.
These stories demonstrate the best of short fiction around at the moment.
The BBC National Short Story Award 2024. Judged by panellists including Michael Doncourt and Di Spears.
The power of the short story remains really exciting for me.
The finalists have been announced, and now you can hear them for yourself every weekday afternoon this week at 3:30.
It's fresh, funny, inventive.
And I think listeners will find lots to enjoy in them.
The BBC National Short Story Award with Cambridge University on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
Coming up in the next hour, a friend of Donald Trump on last night's suspected assassination attempt, and the Home Secretary. What can we learn from Italy about stopping the boats?
You're listening to Today on Radio 4 with Nick Robinson in Ipswich, Justin Webb in London. It's 8 o'clock on Monday, the 16th of September. The headlines this morning. The FBI is investigating an apparent assassination attempt on Donald Trump as he was playing golf in Florida. Sir Keir Starmer will seek to learn lessons from his Italian counterpart when they meet in Rome as he faces pressure to take more action on migrant crossings. A hearing is beginning into allegations Manchester City breached the Premier League's financial rules. And one of the original members of the Jackson Five, Tito Jackson, has died. The BBC News is read this morning by Charles Carroll.
The US Secret Service has thwarted a suspected assassination attempt on Donald Trump while he was playing golf at his resort in Florida. The former president was rushed to safety when agents spotted an assault rifle aimed towards the course. A suspect has been arrested. Our North America editor, Sarah Smith, reports from West Palm Beach.
Donald Trump was only about 300 to 500 yards away when Secret Service agents spotted the barrel of a rifle poking through some bushes on the perimeter of the golf course and opened fire. As Mr. Trump was rushed to safety, the suspect fled the scene in a car. A witness took pictures of the vehicle and the license plate, and a man was later arrested. He has been named in US media as 58-year-old Ryan Wesley Routh. An assault rifle and scope, along with two backpacks and a GoPro camera, were later found at the scene. At a news conference, the Palm Beach County Sheriff Rick Bradshaw praised Mr. Trump's security team.
The Secret Service agent that was on the course did a fantastic job. What they do is they have an agent that jumps one hole ahead of time to where the president was at. And he was able to spot this rifle barrel sticking out of the fence and immediately engage that individual, at which time the individual took off.
BBC Verify has seen social media posts apparently from the suspect, which suggest he was involved in efforts to get foreign fighters into Ukraine. Former President Trump's Secret Service detail has been increased since he was shot at a rally in Pennsylvania just over 2 months ago. But there will still be questions about how someone was able to get so close to him with such a powerful weapon. In an email to supporters, Mr. Trump said his resolve was only stronger after another attempt on his life. "Nothing will slow me down," he added. "I will never surrender."
Sir Keir Starmer is expected to discuss how the UK could follow Italy in dramatically reducing the number of migrant crossings when he holds talks in Rome with the country's Prime Minister, Giorgia Meloni, later today. The UK government has expressed interest in Italy's schemes with Albania, Syria and Libya. Our political correspondent, Alex Forsyth, is travelling with the Prime Minister.
Sir Keir Starmer hopes to learn from Italy, which has seen the number of migrants crossing from North Africa fall by more than 60% in the past year. Financial deals with Tunisia and Libya to strengthen border security are seen to be key. And Italy has also agreed a plan with Albania to process asylum claims, something the Prime Minister's confirmed he's interested in. But the Italian approach hasn't been without controversy, with human rights groups among those expressing concern. With more than 23,000 people having crossed the channel so far this year, the government's conscious of the need for progress. After scrapping the Rwanda scheme, the focus has been on disrupting people smuggling gangs. And now Martin Hewitt, a former chair of the National Police Chiefs Council, has been named as the head of the new Border Security Command. The Conservatives claim Labour is posturing with no real plan.
The Prime Minister's visit to Italy comes as he faces renewed pressure to rethink the UK's immigration policies after 8 migrants died while trying to cross the Channel early yesterday. They were on board a rubber vessel carrying around 60 people, which got into difficulty off the coast of the northern French town of Ambleteuse. Simon Jones is there.
The French authorities admit they are under constant pressure along the coastline of northern France, trying to prevent tragedies at sea. A senior official in the Calais region, Jacques Billon, accused the people smugglers putting migrants onto dangerously overloaded boats of leading them to their deaths. He said that in the past 3 days, 10 people believed to be part of smuggling operations had been arrested, bringing the total for the year to more than 300 people. But he said police officers trying to stop the boats from taking to the water were facing sustained violence.
The UN's Senior Coordinator for Humanitarian Action and Reconstruction in Gaza, Sigrid Karg, says the international community is collectively failing innocent civilians in the territory. Speaking to the BBC, Ms. Karg described Gaza as the most unsafe place in the world to work. Her post was established 9 months ago to improve the delivery of aid. She said systems had been established, but described Gaza as a catastrophe.
"We've built all systems to be in place, but there's no substitute for political will and the political choice to improve matters. The ceasefire and release of the hostages is desperately needed. Not much else can be improved until we reach that point."
An independent commission is to begin its hearing into alleged breaches of the Premier League's financial rules by Manchester City. The club denies any wrongdoing but could be fined, deducted points or even relegated if found guilty by the three-person panel. Here's our sports editor, Dan Rowan.
One of the biggest legal disputes in the history of English football has reached a pivotal stage. A private 10-week hearing is finally set to start today, 18 months after Manchester City were accused by the Premier League of allegedly breaking the rules of the competition that they've won for a record-breaking 4 consecutive seasons. The Independent Commission must decide on a catalogue of 115 charges spread across 14 seasons after the club's Abu Dhabi takeover in 2008 transformed its fortunes. They include allegations that City subverted rules that limit a club's spending by failing to provide accurate financial information over sponsorship revenue, along with full details for manager and player payments. City are also accused of not cooperating with an investigation. The club strongly denies any wrongdoing, and it's said that its case is supported by a comprehensive body of irrefutable evidence.
The Scottish Government is understood to be on the verge of agreeing a deal for the 2026 Commonwealth Games to be held in Glasgow. The event had been due to be held in the Australian state of Victoria, but the bid was withdrawn because of rising costs. It's understood the Australian authorities have now promised a multi-million pound investment to help finalise Glasgow's offer. Primary school numbers in London are predicted to fall by 52,000 pupils in the next 5 years, double the rate of the rest of England. The analysis of government data has been carried out for this programme by the think tank the Education Policy Institute. It says the drop is down to a combination of falling birth rates, the cost of housing and the rising cost of living. The Department for Education says it's increased school funding to almost £62 billion this year. Harry Farley reports.
Primary school pupil numbers across England are falling, but in London, the decline is sharper, and in certain central parts of the capital, the trend is stark. Over the next 5 years, the number of children in primary schools in London is projected to fall by nearly 8%. That's compared to a decline of nearly 4% across the rest of England. The Education Policy Institute, which analysed government data for this programme, says that while the numbers of children in secondary schools is rising, primary schools could face funding shortfalls because of reduced enrolment. A Department for Education spokesperson said the government was looking to repurpose empty primary school classrooms to create 3,000 school-based nurseries.
The Japanese historical drama Shogun has made history at the Emmy Awards ceremony in Los Angeles, becoming the first foreign language television series to win the Best Drama category. It was also a good night for the controversial British TV hit Baby Reindeer. Emma Vardy was on the red carpet and sent this report.
It's the 76th Emmy Awards.
The night of the TV Oscars saw huge success for the show adapted from a one-man play, which became an overnight Netflix hit.
Baby Reindeer!
Baby Reindeer, the most talked-about show of the year, won nearly all of its categories. Richard Gadd, the creator of the series about sexual abuse and stalking, said to be his own real-life story, picked up awards for acting, writing and best drama.
Look, 10 years ago, I was down and out, right? I never ever thought I'd get my life together. I never ever thought I'd be able to rectify myself with what had happened to me and get myself back on my feet again. And then here I am.
Jessica Gunning, who plays the obsessive stalker Martha, won Best Supporting Actress. While Slow Horses, the British spy drama starring Gary Oldman, won in its category for writing, and Elizabeth Debicki won the Best Actress Emmy for playing Princess Diana in the final season of The Crown.
Shogun!
But the show with the most wins of the night was the Japanese series Shogun, which broke records as the most honoured single season of any show in Emmy's history.
Tito Jackson, one of the original members of the Jackson 5, has died at the age of 70. A family friend said he suffered a heart attack while driving. Along with his brothers, Michael, Jermaine, Jackie and Marlon, he helped the family band become a global cultural phenomenon with songs like ABC, I'll Be There and I Want You Back. After decades singing and playing guitar in the group, Tito Jackson became a solo artist in 2003, but continued to perform with the current lineup of the Jacksons. He was last on stage in Germany 6 days ago.
Charles, thank you. 8:10 is the time. A rifle barrel sticking out through shrubbery. That was what alerted Secret Service agents to a potential threat to the life of Donald Trump, who was only 500 yards or so away on his golf course in Florida. The Secret Service fired at the gunman. He escaped, but a bystander took a photo of his car, which was then stopped on the highway nearby. The man has been named by US media as 58-year-old Ryan Wesley Ralph. He's in custody. The threat, it seems, is over, at least for now. President Biden, Vice President Harris both issued statements saying they were glad the former president was safe, condemning political violence. Mr. Trump himself sent an email to supporters saying he was safe and that he would never surrender. I've been talking to a close friend of Donald Trump and a man who supports him politically through the Newsmax TV network that he runs. Chris Ruddy told me what his initial reaction was when he heard about the incident.
I actually wasn't that surprised by it. I think the president remains in a dangerous situation. There are a lot of people that don't like him in this country, and there's a lot of crazy people in this country. I think that he knows that he's in a very dangerous period. I've spoken to him about it. He's very aware of it. I think he realized he was in danger before this, before the Butler shooting, but I think it's come home to him in a very real and dark way.
Yeah, the Butler shooting being the first one, the one that actually hit him or hit his ear. What has he said to you about the dangers that he faces since then?
Well, he's happy that they've stepped up security. We've talked about Mar-a-Lago and a few places now being like armed camps around him. I was just up to see him recently in Bedminster in New Jersey, and the amount of security around him was probably as much or more from when he was president. But, you know, these properties, you have to remember, like, he's got an immense golf club off of downtown West Palm Beach. It's very hard. You need a mini army to secure it. And this is where the shooting supposedly took place today.
Yeah, I'm 500 yards away from him. I mean, I suppose, is it reasonable again to say to the Secret Service, hang on a second, how could this be possible? Or are you saying actually it just would be impossible to completely secure an area like that?
Well, from what I understand, and I'm a member of the club, full disclosure, I've been with the president on the club course many, many times together. It's, again, a very large area, sprawling area. I'm told that the club hasn't reopened for the season, and he made a last-minute decision to be there, that it wasn't planned for him to be there. So it makes some people even more suspicious that this lone person somehow knew he was going to be there. The sheriff of Palm Beach County has said that they're not really allowed to secure the area around the golf club because he's not president yet. And they don't have the legal authority to just lock down the areas around it. This is at least what he claimed in his press conference.
Do you think that the fact of the attempts on him make it more likely that there will be a wider kind of paroxysm of political violence in America? Because these things do tend to go, don't they, in phases?
There's a lot of copycat activities, but I think that we are in a period where there's greater violence in the United States. There's a lot of political polarization. I think it's coming from both sides, and I think we're going to continue to see it for a while.
Do you think Kamala Harris is in danger, similar danger?
Yes. I think Joe Biden's in danger. Even Joe Biden recently said to the press, he was asked why he doesn't go out and talk to the public, and he said the Secret Service says it's just too dangerous for me to do that anymore.
Does Donald Trump bear some responsibility for the wider atmosphere? I mean, you think of when Nancy Pelosi, the former Speaker of the House of Representatives, when her husband was attacked by a madman with a hammer. Donald Trump made light of it. And you can think of other occasions too, can't you, where he's used violent language. Do you think, as a friend of his, that actually he bears some responsibility, not obviously for the attempts on his life, but for the wider sense of violence that there is in American public life?
Well, I think if you look at it, he's largely been the victim of some of these things. He almost had his head blown out and blown apart. It was just a quarter of an inch. Had he not turned to show the crowd something, he would have lost his life. And I don't know what he said about Nancy Pelosi's husband, but if he said something that was inappropriate, that's wrong, and he shouldn't have said it. We did have a situation at January 6th. I don't think it was an insurrection. I do think it was a riot. I think it was inappropriate. But I look back and there were 6 months of cities under siege in America during the George Floyd and the aftermath of George Floyd. There was insurrection in cities. There was burning and looting and people died and were murdered. And the Democrats didn't really have much complaint about that. So looking back, you know, I think there could be a lot of finger pointing. I would rather take the approach that people should unify, that we should do things peacefully, and both sides should be expressing that.
What impact does all of this have on him? You know him well. People who have close calls of all kind are often affected by them. Has he been affected since the first assassination attempt?
I'm sort of amazed. You know, he's the type of guy that doesn't really get ruffled easily, and he doesn't seem to have had any real psychological aftermath of, from what I can see. You know, it's the same old Donald Trump that we're seeing, right? The way he speaks, the way he acts. I think it may have a spiritual impact on him. He's talked about the fact that he believes in God more and things like this, but I'm not sure it necessarily in how he approaches things on a practical level, it's had much of an impact.
And do you think this has a political impact now, this second attempt, if indeed that's what it was?
I don't think it's going to change any voters. I think the middle voters are not going to be moved. I don't think the first attack changed many voters. I think it's going to be a close election. It's his election to lose, but she's on the rise. I mean, the debate was very good for her. I think she won what we call the likability contest right now. She came across as more likable. I'm not so sure she wins the competency test or the performance test. I mean, she's been in office for almost 4 years. If you compare their records, Trump wins hands down.
But I sense a but.
I think the middle voters in America, and it's maybe 4 to 8% right now, are happy with him on his performance. A CNBC poll that came out in the past month showed that it was like a neck and neck race, but they said 2/3 of the voters said, Donald Trump is better for my personal finances. Well, usually in elections, presidential election, whoever's better for your money and your pocketbook wins. He has that number by a wide margin. So there are other factors among people that are holding them back. And I think it's how he approaches things he says and does, just things, some of the things you mentioned in this interview that are concerning to middle voters that make them apprehensive. And he needs to win them over to cross the threshold to win.
Do you think he's getting that advice behind the scenes? And if he is he taking any notice?
He gets it a lot. And sometimes he changes and sometimes he doesn't. But he's a guy that likes to do things his way. And he's done things his way his whole career. And for a large part of it, he's succeeded. He's had a few drawbacks and a few setbacks, but he's always seems to come back.
Chris Ruddy, thank you very much for talking to us.
Great to be on with you.
And just a final thought, if you want to know more about the breaking news in terms of what people are saying about what actually happened, but also the extent to which the Secret Service is being blamed or not blamed, etc., and how it fits into the wider political question in America, there is, of course, an emergency edition of Americast already on BBC Sounds.
Of course. We are subscribed, Justin. We get it automatically via BBC Sounds. It's 18 minutes past 8 now. 8 people died in the Channel yesterday morning when the flimsy boat meant to carry them to a new life in Britain ran aground and was torn apart on rocks before sinking. That, a day after 801 migrants made the crossing safely, as more than 23,000 have so far this year. The stark, the brutal, the bleak reality is that the chances of success are simply too high, the chances of disaster too low to deter desperate people from cramming into unseaworthy inflatables without proper life jackets. There were just 10 on board a boat carrying 60 people. One was given a children's life ring. So what can stop the boats? That is the question the Prime Minister will be discussing in Rome today with his new head of border security at his side. The Italian government is celebrating success in cutting the number of migrants crossing the Mediterranean from North Africa by more than 60% over the past year. But that has produced accusations that a Labour government is aping the policies of the far-right government of Giorgia Meloni. Well, what has the government got in mind? Let's talk to the woman who's still the newish Home Secretary, Yvette Cooper. Good morning. Welcome to the Today programme.
Good morning, Nick.
The Prime Minister promised no more gimmicks on this subject. So what can we learn from Italy?
So this has to be about hard work. What we're doing is setting up a major overhaul of border security, a major upgrade in law enforcement operations against the criminal gangs who are organising these dangerous boat crossings. They are undermining border security and putting lives at risk, as we so tragically saw again this weekend. So we've appointed Martin Hewitt, former police chief, a former army officer as well, great experience in law enforcement, to lead the new Border Security Command, which will draw together the work of the Border Force, the work of the National Crime Agency, the intelligence and security agencies, police forces, and crucially will work with other European countries, including with Italy, including with countries really right along these smuggler routes that that are organising this sort of effectively a trade in people in order to go after those gangs, in order to save lives ultimately, and to make sure that the law is enforced. These gangs have been getting away with it for too long.
Italy's government has had success stopping the boats. Boats that I saw for myself when I travelled for the programme to Tunisia in Italy a while back. But they haven't done it just by cooperation, and they haven't done it just by having a new guy in charge. In part, they say, it is because they send asylum seekers abroad to Albania to have their claims processed. The Prime Minister seems to be suggesting we could possibly do something similar. Is that right?
Well, that arrangement is actually not in place at the moment. It's still being worked on between Italy and Albania. So the things that have made the difference over the last 12 months, where you're right, we have seen about a 60% reduction in boats crossing the Mediterranean, very dangerous route to arrive in Italy. The things that seem to have made the difference there have been, first of all, around prevention work with North African countries, including with Tunisia, as part of the Matteo Agreement. Secondly, work against organised immigration crime, going after the gangs and the criminal networks that are organising this. And thirdly, having more effective returns, swift returns for those who don't have a right to be in Italy. And in each of those are three areas that we also want to substantially increase the work that we do and have that work underway as well, around prevention, around going after the gangs, and also we have been increasing returns very significantly this summer to make sure that rules are properly respected and enforced.
But I take your point, there are other things they've done, and those arrangements in Albania are not operating yet. Are we looking at them? If they work, will Britain be prepared? Will this Labour government be prepared to say, we'll process migration claims abroad, different from the Rwanda scheme, because people could still come back to Britain, as they can come back to Italy if they successfully claim asylum. Are we prepared to do that?
Well, we've always said we will look at anything that works. Clearly, things have to be workable, they have to be financially viable, and they also have to meet international standards as well. As you know, obviously, the Rwanda scheme operated for 2.5 years, spent £700 million to send just four volunteers to Kigali, and clearly wasn't a workable or effective scheme.
Sure, but this is a different scheme.
It's very different. So we will obviously look at anything that works. The thing, though, that's also significant about what the Italy-Albania arrangement is around is particularly looking at those who have arrived from countries that are predominantly safe countries, that are most likely to be swiftly rejected and to return, and to have a fast-track arrangement for them. We think there are other ways to develop a new fast-track system. It's something we've always been interested in, to make sure that those who have come from predominantly safe countries can have their cases very swiftly decided, properly, fairly decided, and then also be swiftly returned as well. Because that is, I think, about how making sure that the rules are being properly respected and enforced.
Now, there's another thing that the Italians do, and it's controversial. They frustrate, they prosecute NGOs, charities, that pick up and save migrants at sea. Indeed, the former Interior Minister Salvini is facing a possible 6 years in prison for preventing a rescue boat docking in Italy. What do you say to people who say, people in your party, people in refugee charities, you shouldn't be meeting people like this, you shouldn't be listening to people like this, you've nothing to learn from them?
Well, we have very different arrangements in the channel. There is very close cooperation between the UK and French authorities, including with organisations like the RNLI, the French different rescue authorities that work to make sure that everything possible is done to save lives, and in cooperation between those organisations. And they have a very coordinated approach. You've seen that operate, whether there have been boats that have got into difficulty in French waters or in UK waters, and that cooperation will continue. But you know, we should be preventing the boats leaving the French coast in the first place.
Yeah, but there's the tension, isn't there? Which is, Tony Smith, who used to be head of border security, says, look, Italy's success is based on the fact that they are prepared to see human rights violations. They cooperate with governments we don't much like in Libya, in Tunisia. They do frustrate charities trying to rescue boats at sea. They, in other words, try and increase the chances that these journeys are not successful. Is that something you're willing to do because you think stopping the boats is important enough?
We think that the work that Italy has been doing around serious and organised crime is immensely important. We should be doing the same as that. We actually should be gearing up far more. And what I think both the UK and Italy share is an interest in increasing the work that Europol does, increasing the coordinated work right across Europe. I think there are substantial things there that we can do. We will always ensure that proper standards are met. We will always ensure that that cooperation is done effectively, but really, frankly, there hasn't been the kind of cooperation that we need across Europe, where a lot of the boats that reach the French coast, the engines that reach the French coast and so on, all of that is very often people travelling through Europe, and the smuggler gangs are operating right across the continent. We haven't had that cooperation before, and too often I think there was just a bit too much just shouting from the last Conservative government. They shouted, but they didn't do things. They shouted at other countries rather than working with them. We just think you've got to work with people.
Seeing more deaths in the Channel, Home Secretary, because you, as you say, forgive me, you're saying lives are lost, not only the loss of life on Saturday, but there were also, yesterday, I'm sorry, 8 deaths. There were another, 14, weren't there, quite recently. There is, or appears to be, an increase in the number of people dying making this crossing. What's the explanation?
Yeah, so this looks like this is about the way in which the smuggler gangs are operating. And I think a lot of this is about them being driven to try and make more money, which is what makes this such a horrific trade in people. So they are cramming more people into boats. We've seen women and children ending up being crushed to death and or drowning as a result of being crammed into these boats. We've seen greater violence from the smuggler gangs. And we've also seen these life jackets, which really are not life jackets at all, just sort of flimsy things pretending to be life jackets, which is more part of duping people, conning people, making them pay extra for a life jacket that isn't a life jacket, giving them false reassurance whilst they're put out to the sea.
Some say it's because there are fewer boats. Fewer boats are making the journey, which is in some sense a success. Fewer boats, I'm sorry, are reaching the shores of France because of some intelligence success in intercepting the supplies. And as a result, those gangs are cramming more and more people onto the few boats they have got.
I think the problem with the criminal gangs is they want to make profit. So I think they would be, there's risk then the tactics that they use are becoming increasingly dangerous as they are trying to make more money. And
just
that's what's
one
so
more idea to ask
trade.
You about in this space, which is there are people who say, look, you'll never deal with this problem if you don't deal with what some people call the pull factors. One minister quoted anonymously in the Times, a colleague of yours today, saying as long as there's demand to come to the UK, there will always be smugglers who provide. Don't you need to make it much harder to work illegally in Britain, to claim benefits in Britain, if we are not to be what the French Interior Minister recently described as El Dorado?
Well, you can't claim benefits if you're here illegally, and we do think that there needs to be much stronger action and enforcement against illegal working, including against employers who are exploiting people and making profits out of migration as well. And that's why this summer, in fact, we launched a major new programme to increase the action against illegal working, to increasing raids, increasing enforcement, and that has led to an increase in fines being put against employers, the stronger action we will take against employers. We want to keep upgrading that. So I agree with you. There hasn't been strong enough action against employers who are exploiting people, and we will increase that.
Finally, Home Secretary, the Foreign Secretary implied yesterday that he thought the taxpayer might, in certain situations, need to pay for clothes for the Prime Minister and his wife. Do you think for now the Prime Minister really needs donations from party donors to buy clothes for his wife?
So I don't think that's what the Foreign Secretary was saying. I think he was just talking about different arrangements in other countries. I don't think that's what he was saying. I think that you're referring to this issue around political donations and a declaration that's been made. I don't know the details of the donations, but I understand that the Prime Minister has, or Prime Minister's office, had sought advice around these declarations and has, as a result of that, made a further declaration. That is the right thing to do.
Home Secretary Yvette Cooper, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Half past eight is the time. To Carthy in the sport.
Thank you very much. Good morning. The hearing into Manchester City's 115 charges of alleged breaches of the Premier League's financial rules begins today. The football club was charged and referred to an independent commission in February of 2023 following a four-year investigation. Manchester City strongly deny all of the charges. Well, we can speak to Stephen Flynn, a barrister who specialises in sport arbitration. Stephen, it is alleged that City breached the financial rules over 14 seasons after the Abu Dhabi takeover of the club, and these allegations first surfaced in 2018. Why has it taken so long to get to this point?
Good morning. Yes, it has taken a long period, but that can be explained by what we know that's in the public domain. First of all, there was the UEFA investigation and disciplinary process, which led to Manchester City being banned from European club competitions for 2 years. Now, that was overturned in July 2020, but the Premier League investigation sat behind that. So we're only looking at the period really after that. Then we know that there was a High Court process in 2021 about which documents Manchester City were required to disclose to the Premier League, which contributed to the period to today. As you say, the charges were in February 2023, and Manchester City were then given a period in which to prepare their defence and eventually to convene the panel who's going to hear the charges today.
It is an unprecedented case in football, probably in sport overall. Why, though, is this so complex?
Well, the Premier League and UEFA financial rules are complex in themselves, and when the panel comes to consider them, they'll need to determine a mixture of legal, factual and accounting issues over a 9 or 14 year period. And during that nine year period in which they're looking at the financial regulations, there were changes to the rules, and those changes may be relevant to whether the charges are made out. And then, as you've already mentioned, the Manchester City's defence is that there is a paper trail showing that they have not misled the league and they've not done nothing improper. And unpicking that and determining that will be evidentially complex. And that's why a 6 to 8 week period has been allowed for the panel to consider that.
Yeah, it is a long case. But what are the potential ramifications for City and also for the Premier League?
Well, obviously, for sports fans, the potential implication is what will happen to the Premier League if the decision's in the spring and there's a points deduction that may impact who wins the league. And if there's appeal, it could go into the following season and impact that season. In terms of Manchester City, if they're found to have done something seriously wrong, then expulsion is an option for the panel, but I think that's highly unlikely. If it's a serious misfinding, then points deduction, such as that had a practical implication of relegating Manchester City, is something that could happen. Then there's also a suggestion that other clubs may seek to bring claims against Manchester City if breaches are found to have been made out. But I'm not sure there's really a sound legal basis for that. For the Premier League, they are now going to have a panel look at their profit and sustainability rules and see if they're fit for purpose. If there's a finding on technical grounds that Manchester City haven't breached, then it may cause those rules to be reviewed and amended. And it would have implications for the whole league then. Whatever the outcome, the ramifications are likely to be significant.
Yeah, I think so. We've got a long time to wait, though. Until that happens, I'm sure we'll be speaking again. Stephen Flynn, thank you very much. Well, Manchester City are top of the Premier League with Arsenal 2 points behind them after a 1-0 win over Tottenham. Arsenal have now defeated Tottenham away for 3 seasons in a row. Newcastle United are in third place. They came from behind to beat Wolves 2-1, and Rangers had a 1-0 win over Dundee United in the Scottish Premiership. Golf, and despite a final day fight back by Europe, who were 10-6 down on Sunday, the USA Rory won the Solheim Cup by 15.5 points to 12.5 points. Rory McIlroy has admitted he's getting used to near misses after he led by 4 strokes yesterday at the Irish Open but finished in second place at Royal County Down. And Oscar Piastri won Formula One's Azerbaijan Grand Prix. McLaren teammate Lando Norris finished in fourth place. He's just 59 points behind the championship leader Max Verstappen now. And in tennis, British number 4 Sonia Cartel won her first WTA Tour title in Tunisia, while Great Britain will not progress to the Davis Cup finals in November. They were defeated by Canada in Manchester yesterday.
Cathy, thank you. It's Monday, so start the week. We'll be returning at 9 o'clock, and Tom Sutcliffe can tell us more.
Morning, Nick. Very good to be back. Joining us this morning, fresh from a meeting with President Zelensky in Kyiv, is the historian Timothy Snyder, whose new book on freedom has been profoundly shaped by what's happening in that country. And with him, to talk about that bloody fault line between democratic societies and an autocratic one, are the poet Oksana Maksimchuk, who captures the paradoxes and terrors of the invasion in her latest collection, and Lucy Ash, whose book The Baton and the Cross examines how the Russian Orthodox Church is helping Putin prosecute his war abroad and suppress dissent at home. Let's start the week, restarting after the summer break, raring to go just after nine.
Tom, thank you. And there's a very cheerful weather forecast to go along with it. Today is expected to come largely dry, plenty of sunshine, turning a little warmer too. Summer's back.
Blissful here in Suffolk. You're listening to Today on Radio 4. Justin Webb in London. Me, Nick Robinson in Ipswich at 25 minutes to nine. Charles Carroll has a summary of the news.
The US Secret Service has thwarted a suspected assassination attempt on Donald Trump at his golf resort in Florida. The former president was rushed to safety when agents spotted an assault rifle aimed towards the course. A suspect has been arrested. The CEO of Newsmax Media, Chris Ruddy, told us Mr. Trump, who's a close friend, already knew he was in a very dangerous period, but the attempts on his life had brought home that he was in a very, very real and dark way. The Prime Minister is facing renewed pressure to rethink the UK's immigration policies after 8 migrants died while trying to cross the Channel yesterday. Sir Keir Starmer is in Rome for talks with his Italian counterpart Giorgia Meloni on issues including migration. The Home Secretary, Yvette Cooper, told us the new Border Security Command, led by the former head of the National Police Chiefs Council, Martin Hewitt, would work with other European law enforcement organisations to go after the criminal gangs organising the Channel crossings. The Scottish Government is understood to be on the verge of agreeing a deal for the 2026 Commonwealth Games to be held in Glasgow. The event had been due to be held in the Australian state of Victoria, but the bid was withdrawn because of rising costs. And Tito Jackson, one of the original members of the Jackson 5, has died at the age of 70. He was instrumental in helping the group become a global cultural phenomenon.
Thank you. It is 23 minutes to nine. How much of a threat to us all comes from the growing alliance between Iran and Russia? There have been suggestions that there is a growing concern in London and Washington about the friendship and the flows of support and weaponry and indeed technical information that might flow in ever-growing volumes, including, as Antony Blinken, the US Secretary of State, has suggested, nuclear issues, as he put it. In a moment, we'll hear from a former UK ambassador to Iran, but first to our international editor, Jeremy Bowen, who is on the line. A lot of people pricked up their ears when Antony Blinken mentioned nuclear issues, because, of course, the possibility being that Russian help assists Iran in coming closer to building a nuclear weapon.
Yes, I mean, the situation is that Iran has enriched uranium, which, if it enriches it a little bit more, and it's at a technical level where it could do that, it could be used to make a nuclear device. The next technical challenge, if they wanted to have a nuclear weapon, and they absolutely deny that they do, Ayatollah Khomeini issued a fatwa against nuclear weapons, but if they decided they did want to do that, then the challenge would be how you make that device, how you attach it to the top of a missile, basically. And of course, Russia, which has a massive nuclear arsenal and generations of knowledge about this, knows exactly how to do that. The question, though, is whether President Putin, who, aside from invading Ukraine, is, it used to be seen as being actually quite cautious, would he really want to share that kind of technology? Historically, the Russians haven't been doing that kind of thing.
I suppose it's how desperate he gets.
Yeah, sure. And, you know, he is also, though, at the same time benefiting from alliances that he's got. From the Chinese, he gets microelectronics. From North Korea, they've been getting shells. And from Iran, they've been getting drones. And now, according to the US and the UK, and the Iranians again deny this, ballistic missiles with a 75-mile range, so pretty short range, but ones that would give them another option in terms of hammering the Ukrainians, and particularly with the winter coming, hammering their energy infrastructure. So I think it's something, what is emerging globally is a series of alliances, and China is at the heart of these, but Iran is part of it and Russia is part of it, which essentially bypass the dominant set of alliances in the world since, well, the middle part, say, well, since early in the 20th century, which is in the West. And that's something as well, which on a longer term level, I think Western governments are finding increasingly alarming, because it means that if they want to try and influence those countries, for example, by sanctions, it's actually very hard to do it.
Yeah. Jeremy Bowen, thank you for that, because that sets up very nicely Rob McCare, who's on the line, who was the UK ambassador to Iran between 2018 and 2021. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
What can the West do about it, if indeed anything?
Well, I mean, you have to remember that this relationship between Iran and Russia obviously isn't new, and it didn't start with the invasion of Ukraine. I mean, up until that point, Russia and Iran had quite a close relationship, including on nuclear matters, because of course Russia built Iran's nuclear reactor in Bushehr, so supporting its civil nuclear program. But you know, Russia had been in international diplomacy, been willing to play a constructive role in constraining Iran's program under the negotiations that led to the JCPOA, the nuclear agreement. And after that, it was never an easy partner, but it was willing to play that role despite having a relationship with Iran. And I think that relationship has always been, you know, one of my enemy's enemy is my friend. It's not a deep, close cultural relationship or people-to-people or trading relationship. It's about resisting Western hegemony.
Yeah, so does that mean, I mean, for instance, does it mean that the Iranians have an interest in seeing Russia successful in Ukraine, not because of anything to do with Ukraine, which obviously is a long way from Iran and not particularly to do with Iran, but simply because it ties up the Western world, NATO, the US, in something that keeps them away from Iran?
Yes, absolutely. That's exactly how Iran would see it. I think the foreign policy and security policy establishment in Tehran would have welcomed the fact that Russia is increasingly allied with what they would call the axis of resistance. So resistance to what we would say is the rules-based order.
And when it comes to help from Russia with nuclear technology, I mean, do you think there is now? I mean, you're not any longer the ambassador. I don't know how closely you follow these things. But obviously, Antony Blinken seemed to suggest that there is actually evidence in the intelligence world that there is nuclear technology information coming from Russia to Iran now.
Well, as you say, I'm no longer privy to any of the information that might be known inside the system. But what I would say is that there is, you know, obviously a lot that Russia can do to support a civil nuclear program in Iran, where of course there's a blurred line between that program and the ability to then go for nuclear weapons. So it's not necessarily, there could be technical assistance that doesn't consist of actually trying to help Iran to build a weapon, but could, for example, accelerate the speed at which they could enrich and streamline their enrichment capacity.
Yeah. Rob McCare, we've got to leave it there. Thank you very much, Rob McCare, okay. Former UK ambassador to Iran, and Jeremy Bowen as well.
It's now 17 minutes to 9. A few months back, we asked listeners to Today to suggest ideas for stories that we should look into. A small thing called the general election delayed us in bringing you some of the answers to the questions that you raised. But just over an hour ago, and indeed throughout this week, you will hear and have heard listeners raising questions. Today was the turn of Vanessa and Toby, parent governors at a secondary school in South London, the borough of Southwark, who called their proposal to us the Ballad of the disappearing children. They've noticed far fewer children and families where they live, and they asked us to look into why pupil numbers are falling in central London, and falling, it seems, faster than elsewhere.
The numbers of children round here seem to be decreasing. The numbers of small children, babies being born, the number of admissions has reduced at secondary schools, and that is the case throughout Southwark and other boroughs nearby.
And we moved here when he was three. I remember touring round primary schools and, you know, the primary schools were so overcrowded, they were teaching kids in the corridor. And then four primary schools have closed in this area in the last 2 years.
Well, we asked the Education Policy Institute to do some research for us on that. Research that showed that primary school numbers have fallen by 5% in London in the last 5 years, and they're projected to fall at double the rate of the rest of England over the next five. Let's talk to Louis Hodge, who's Associate Director of the EPI, the Education Policy Institute, who's been looking at the data on behalf of the programme. Morning to you.
Good morning.
Let's begin with the facts then. What are the facts telling you about the picture in London and elsewhere? And are you able to explain the facts as well as to outline the data?
Sure. So we've seen, as you were pointing out, that in the last 5 years, the number of pupils in primary schools in London has fallen by around 34,000, which is about 5%. And these falls are much bigger than elsewhere in the country, where primary school pupil numbers have remained roughly stable over the last 5 years. And as you have pointed out in Southwark and highlighted there, that this is particularly in central London boroughs, which have actually experienced falls that are greater than 10% in the last 5 years. And we are predicting that there will be further reductions at primary school. So a further 50,000 primary pupils fewer by 2028. And this is going to keep working its way through the system. So at the moment, secondary pupil numbers have actually been increasing over the last 5 years, but that is starting to tail off as those primary school pupils start moving through the system. And so that we're saying by 2028, that's looking much more flat. And beyond that, we'd start expecting pupil numbers at secondary to also fall. So in places like Southwark, we're actually expecting over the next 5 years, even at secondary, a 14% fall in the number of places.
Now, let's talk about the headline reasons then. The obvious one for the pattern in the country as a whole is fewer people having children or people are having fewer children. Is that right?
That's probably what's driving most of it. So there's a plethora of reasons that potentially could be causing the fall in pupil numbers. But birth rates is definitely a big reason. So birth rates peaked in around 2010 and have been falling ever since. And in London, we've seen even bigger falls over that period.
So the question is, why in London then? Is it because, quite simply, people can't afford to live in central London? So if you're having kids, the worry about childcare costs, the worry about housing costs, is felt all over the country, but is particularly severe in the central London.
Exactly. So I think it's a particularly acute problem in London, as you say, whether that's housing, childcare, other costs. And that means we're seeing a kind of parents-to-be leaving the capital, and those that even are staying potentially delaying or deciding to have less or even no children.
And a quick final thought, might this be rather good news for a government short of money, or that says it's short of money? If you kept education spending roughly where it is now, you get more bang for your buck because there are fewer children in schools.
That's potentially true. It depends whether that money is kept in the education system and not moved elsewhere to finance other things in government. But I think it does pose a challenge for schools themselves and local authorities, because most of the funding, as you rightly point out, is predominantly allocated on a pupil basis. That means that schools may actually start to struggle to be financially viable. We might actually see some school closures in the future, which obviously has some potential ill effects on pupils and staff that have to then move.
Yeah, interestingly, the government is saying that they might use some of those empty primary school classrooms for new nurseries for preschool children. Louis Hodge of the Education Policy Institute, thank you.
9:12 is the time. Hanif Qureshi, the writer of The Buddha of Suburbia, My Beautiful Laundrette, so many other wonderful works, one of our greatest writers. He was having a beer watching the football on Boxing Day 2022 when, as he puts it, everything went fuzzy and I landed on my head. That accident changed the life of one of our finest writers, who thought for a time that the game was up, but now reveals for the first time in a BBC documentary that he is up and running, at least metaphorically.
The writing hasn't stopped. It keeps you alive because when you're sick, you become an object for the doctors. You become an object for the people who have to look after you. So maintaining your creativity, your individuality is the thing. It's kept me alive wanting to be a writer, and I've written things that I would never have written otherwise. I know that.
I've been talking to Hanif Qureshi, and we started with how he was.
I had my accident on Boxing Day the year before last. I spent a whole year in hospital, some of it in Italy, the rest in three hospitals in the UK. And I finally came out last Christmas. So I've been out for about 9 months, Justin, and I'm beginning to cheer up after going through all that. I'm a little bit stronger than I was. I've written my book, Shattered, which is coming out in October. I've got a play coming on at the Barbican, the Buddha of Suburbia, and I've got this film coming out on Monday. So what I want to do is to get back to work and to be a writer again, rather than just, you know, a body being rolled around on an NHS bed by nurses and prodded by doctors and so on.
Yeah. You sound strong. And I wonder if part of that is that you are back at work again and that that is helping as much as the doctors have.
I broke my neck, more or less, but I can work. I can still speak. I haven't got any cognitive impairment, thank God. And so I'm what my partner describes as a talking vegetable.
Has it changed you artistically?
After I had my accident and I was in intensive care, I had a very strong desire to write and to tell my story. And so my partner, Isabella, would sit at the end of the bed and she would start tapping away on her phone and I would shout at her about what I was going through. And I always had a very strong desire to speak about what had happened to me and to go through the details of what it was like to be in hospital and so on. And I soon found when we started publishing, thousands of people were connecting to this material around the world. And that really cheered me up. If you're lying in bed for days and weeks and months on your own, often through the night, alone and depressed, the thought that there are people out there who will receive your words and will continue to maintain you as a writer was very, very cheering for me and very important.
And the involvement of your family, you mentioned your partner, but your sons as well, and we see that in the film.
My boys, they were on a rota and they came to Rome every weekend, and I wrote with them, and now I've written a whole book.
Has it left you more positive or less positive about life itself?
I was happy before my accident, and I was very happy with Isabella, and we had a good life together, half in Rome, half in London. And then one day, sitting in a chair, I wasn't even drunk. I was watching a football match. I fell on my head, and I went through this door into a world of illness, into a world of hospitals, and into another reality, really, where people really suffer and then they die. And it was something I hadn't thought about so much. So to answer your question, I'm much more aware now of how vulnerable we are, not only that we must die, that we must be looked after by other people, that we will all, in the end, probably end up in the arms of strangers.
One associates what you write with a wider kind of sense of commentary on our culture and obviously about racism, also to an extent about fanaticism and people's inability to get on when perhaps they ought to be getting on. This does bring a, I mean, to put it mildly, a new perspective to all of that, doesn't it?
Well, I think it made me aware that in every family, there's going to be somebody who will be ill or dying or disabled, suffering from dementia and so on, and that we really have to enlarge our capacity to include the ill or the disabled and so on. Particularly at this time when as you know, throughout Europe, there's an ever-increasing aging population, that people will live longer, but they may be ill for some of that time. And the other issue, which connects to this, Justin, as you know, is the issue of immigration, which is to do with how we're going to continue to maintain our NHS and how we're going to continue to maintain the care system. Because when I was in the hands of the NHS during that period in hospital, almost everybody who looked after me was either from the Philippines or from South Africa or from other African countries and from India and so on. And all the hospitals that I was in were understaffed, and they were desperate for people to come and work here. So you run immediately into this deadlock, which is at the center of our politics, which is how we're going to bring enough people over to look after our aging population and what that means in terms of immigration and so on.
Another subject which you've touched on, you've written about recently, is AI, which I think most people would feel is potentially a threat, actually, to authorship and to good writing, particularly as people use it more and more. What's your experience of it, and what do you make of it?
It's a tool, and I found it very useful. My boys find it very useful. And it's a very amusing tool because it's incredibly clever. But I don't think it's ever going to replace the human imagination, because the AI doesn't have any experience. And my work comes out of my experience, out of my feeling, out of my intelligence, out of my sensibility. AI will never have that. It can't have that. It can't be a human being. So I would advise young writers to experiment with it, to use it, to see whether it can, as it were, prod their imaginations into more interesting places.
Hanif Qureshi, pleasure to talk to you. Thank you very much.
And in my own words, with Hanif Qureshi, BBC One tonight at 20 to 11.
It's 5 to 9 now. Every wind turbine we block, every solar farm we reject, every piece of grid we fail to build make us less secure and more exposed. That is what the new Energy Secretary, Ed Miliband, will say in a major speech tomorrow, in which we're told he'll say that what he calls his clean energy sprint is the national security, energy security, economic fight of our time. Well, if it is a fight, the front line of it is here in East Anglia, just up the road from where I'm broadcasting in Ipswich this morning, where so much of the country's wind power is generated offshore, and plans to build a huge new energy hub near a beautiful village in Greenfields just off the coast, near the resort of Aldborough, are being opposed by some locals, amongst them Fiona Gilmore, who's the founder and director of something called SEAS, Suffolk Energy Action Solutions, and joins us on the line. Morning to you. Tell us what's planned and why you and others are opposing it.
Good morning, Nick. What's planned is the biggest energy infrastructure hub in Europe, over 80 football pitches of concrete, converter stations and substations, 3 miles from a tourism resort. And this, if you like, not only is needlessly destructive, but what is planned is in fact unnecessary, because you do not need to build this onshore at all. There is a better alternative.
Yeah, the name of your organisation, SEAS, is a hint at what that alternative is. It's taking the grid out to sea rather than having it on the land. Is that right?
So our solution that we've researched over 5 years using some of the best engineers in the world, and what Belgium, Holland, Denmark and Germany are already doing, is creating an offshore grid where you take your offshore wind, which we're passionately in favour of, and you pool it at sea at offshore platforms, 2 or 3 wind farms at a time. And you take it in a family of subsea cables to brownfield sites closer to demand. And this is viable today. We need to get in the queue now to ensure that we can do it, because the alternative is asymmetric, disproportionate destruction and needless of this extraordinary area, where we have some of the most vital wetlands, heathlands, the equivalent of a tropical rainforest. And this biodiversity needless destruction, it's not necessary. And in the name of progress, we do not need to increase our biodiversity loss.
But, they say, implied in Ed Miliband's words about having a fight is that he's prepared to have a fight with you. And he will say that a lot of people objecting are wealthy second homeowners, people who've retired from London into fancy homes here in Suffolk, who want to resist anything changing. And he says he's in a clean energy sprint. He hasn't got time to delay while you design and think through and build a new infrastructure off the coast.
It's- It's precisely because we need to accelerate that we need to look at what we're proposing, because it's quicker, it's faster. And why is it faster? Because you don't need to build half of the infrastructure onshore. It's completely redundant. So our way is faster. It's cheaper for the consumer. There's an overall cost saving of $6 billion. And on top of that, you enhance your grid resilience. You increase your flexibility because it's like a network. You can import, export. You can take it straight to demand. And there is a smaller onshore footprint. So we're saying to Ed Miliband...